Get ready for the O'Shelley effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck O'Shelley, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelley! Yeah!
25th day of May, 2018, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the O'Shelley Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of O'Shelley.com, also heard on various affiliate networks. So, good Friars Day evening to you, if you're catching this live. If not, you could be catching us further on down the stream via your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, podcatcher, du jour, etc., and we appreciate you as well. So, I didn't do the show last night because I was not up to it, and it just seemed like the thing to do, but couldn't turn down the opportunity to do tonight's show. Why? I have Daniel Lewis Crumpton with me from downloadedcontent.com. He's the author of Then Came the Flood, which is a book available on Amazon.com and other places, but if you go to downloadedcontent.com, I'm very sure you can learn a great deal more about Mr. Crumpton. And if you haven't heard him before, welcome to my show. I always appreciate new listeners because he's been here for the past couple of years. Anyway, on top of that, what are we discussing tonight? Well, it sounds like it's time to break down a little bit of the entertainment medium. Why is that? We're discussing Infinity War, which, this is a Marvel comic thing, yes, indeed. And is this going to get into esoteric societal issues? Is this going to get into, current events? Guess we'll have to wait and see. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Hey, man. Have you spurned any more prepubescent pedophiles in your circles these days, Chuck?
You know what? I make a lot of people angry, apparently, and some people make YouTube videos about it, and some people get angry and upset with me because, I have four listeners that they apparently covet. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm really just not caring about that too much at the moment. How about you?
It makes for good entertainment, man, and inside jokage.
Well, you know, that's for sure, and, I guess if you're in the position where you can't figure out whether you want to present yourself as an anarchist or as an anarcho-fascist, maybe you want to be part of Antifa because you believe it's a real thing, and you think also that since you're a younger person, you're somehow more knowledgeable than everybody else, and that older people are just old because they're stupid and old because they're stupid and old. I guess, you know, there's ways of dealing with that. You know, what am I going to do?
Yeah, it is what it is.
That's the way it is.
Yeah, here's the way I look at it, man. I don't really care what you say about me. Just spell my name right, you know, as the old adage goes.
Well, yeah, and you know what? If you can't spell my name right, I will offer to assist you. not a big deal. Not a big deal. And, you know, get it at least close to right, and we're good. I'm happy that way, you know, and so there it is. And meanwhile, if I had an ego, I might be upset, you know. It's just, I don't. I mean, that's the funny thing, too, is that for some reason, there's this small contingent of individuals who've been around me on occasion on this show who get this impression about me, about how I have a certain ego. It's like, well, look, he's named his show after it. Well, that was just a lack of creativity on my part. You know, I put my last name on the show so it would be unique and I wouldn't be hiding behind anything. That's really the whole of my thought process there. And that's the end of it. Outside of that, it's like, well, look, he puts his name on everything. Well, you kind of got to coherently brand things together in order to make a presentation. But other than that, I don't think of myself as superior to anybody. Have you ever noted me to really, like, take a superior? And here's the thing. Daniel and I deal with each other in real life, too.
Yeah. I think that's the big disconnect between a lot of these internet peoples is, you know, their disconnect from real life. Me and you actually know each other in real life. So, you know, it's funny to me when I hear people critiquing you or slamming you or whatever. Yeah, you're a human being. You got your warts. You know, but for the most part, you're a pretty humble guy. Like, you're a really humble guy. So it's funny whenever I see people in internet land, they're like saying whatever they're saying about you or me or some of these other people that we actually know in real life. It's hilarious.
Well, it is. It's really funny. And in fact, you know, sitting there and watching people say they do stuff for money.
Oh, and did you work for the CIA? Me and you both. We work for the CIA.
That's a trick.
Did you get that one?
Yeah,
have you
heard
like
that
one? Right. If those people only knew. And I was like, well, shit, I hadn't got a check from them here recently, so what exactly am I doing for the CIA?
Yeah, well, look, I me neither, and if this is the case, I'd like my back pay, cause I never got my front pay. You know, and the FBI is not fond of me, I know that, but, you know, what am I gonna do?
Everybody lives in their own little world, man, that's, I guess, the topic of tonight's discussion, but everybody has their own story, their own little reality, and they're all inviting you to join it, you know, and it's just funny. It's really, really funny because if people only knew, like, what really goes on behind the scenes of what you do and what I do, oh, my God. It's ridiculous. Well, we work for the CIA.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. You know, the CIA usually doesn't get blind guys to do too much. I mean, I know I did apply for a job where I could use my ears at one point with the NSA. I did that. That's a true story. Back in the early 2000s. But I was, you know, turned down because I wasn't, you know, quite malleable for their purposes. You know, but I did have some skills that they might have been able to use as signals analyst, and I thought it was a good thing to do at the time. Obviously, I've thought differently since and did not get that job. But it's amazing to me for people to think that I would work for some intelligence agency of any kind. Because, again, if you knew me at any point in my life, you would think this is exactly the guy that the CIA would not hire. You know, because I don't fall into line with these programs. I will fight with everybody over an idea or what I think is right. I mean, I'm disagreeable in that way. I do not play well with others when it comes to taking orders and things. I mean, would you agree with that?
It's funny stuff, man. It's funny stuff. No, Chuck does not work for the CIA, for Christ's sakes.
No. I mean, it would be the most... I don't even know what to say anymore.
You know? Me and you got a good chuckle out of that, though. I'm not even going to dignify any of that with like a true response or a name drop or anything, but if people are clever enough, they can go and look what we're talking about, and it's just the most hilarious stuff. It really, really is funny.
Oh, no, I find people having their meltdowns about things that were not provoked by anything real.
Oh, that's another thing. Don't you find, like, in the world and the circles that me and you interact with, the people who are, like, in alternative media or whatever we're supposed to be, I don't know, like, eventually everybody has, like, a flip-out session at some point or another? What do you think that's about?
Well, I think because, first of all, a lot of people that are trying to reach for something other are doing it because they've been rejected. You know, and sometimes they've been rejected with good reason. I mean, some people are rejected because they're maverick in their thinking. They're a bit of a renegade naturally, you know, and therefore they've always had sort of a rebellious nature. And those kind of people, you know, they generally cut against the grain a little bit, even maybe when they shouldn't, which is something I do on occasion. And I'm aware of it, and I'm trying to correct it as I get older, for sure. But, you know, because it's not always the smartest thing to do strategically to always cut against the grain. You know what I'm saying? It has its place. But what's interesting is that some people are just... you know, toxic human beings that couldn't fit in to normal social circles,
yeah.
Couldn't interact intellectually with others, and they turn into something else. And I mean, look, there's a place for everybody in the world, even if you are kind of a bit of a narcissistic, you know, self-destructive, self-mutilating, either emotionally or physically, individual. I mean, there's a place for you, but I don't want to be anywhere near you. And, you know, if you alienate everybody you encounter, I mean, eventually you're going to find yourself in a circle where you're going to have to say either I belong nowhere or now I belong in this other place where it seems like everybody else has gravitated there because they start to think that the reason why people are outside of the mainstream is because they have also been rejected. That's not always the case. And it's fascinating.
I don't know. I think the internet plays a huge part in that. You know, with the whole Andy Warhol saying in the future everybody would have 15 minutes of fame, and now they do. You know, now everybody can live stream or do a podcast. And you know, I've been in a real meditative state for the past couple of weeks, and I was like, what? You know, I'm very introspectively saying, who am I? What does it matter if I go on any radio show and say anything? Why do people even want to listen to me, or do they listen to me? Is it just me and whoever? You know, and what does it really matter? You know, asking real serious questions like that, but that's because, you know that I haven't found all the answers yet, and when you do meet somebody who's found all the answers, run the other way. But I think that the internet, because it has allowed everybody to have 15 minutes of fame, and like now it's become an addiction to constantly let the world or an imaginative world know what you're doing every second of the day and be able to live stream it. I mean, it's completely opposite of give me my privacy. Nobody wants privacy anymore. They want like an echo chamber of themselves. Almost, you know, and I understand that people like you and me and people who are in alternative media and stuff, to a great degree, we do have to self-promote because nobody else is going to promote for us or promote us. You know, maybe a few like diehard people who dig what we're doing or dig what we're saying. But for the most part, you know, I think that the ability for everyone to go live 24 hours a day has created this echo chamber that makes them at some point flip out when there's even one inclination that the world is not about them. You know what I'm saying? Like they do, the internet's kind of bending us to become a little narcissistic to a degree, and people who aren't grounded, they do, they flip out. And it's you can almost, me and you at this point can almost predict when somebody's about to flip out on you, and you know, either it gets crazy. You know, I don't know if I'm a conspiracy theorist. I believe in, you know, there is no such thing as coincidences, and weird things do happen, and there is a surveillance state and all this good stuff. But some people do. Holy crap. At some point, they're just not made for the internet, and they flip out, and they start lashing out at everybody that ever tried to give them a leg up, or gave them the time of day, or, you know, tried to encourage them to be their most authentic self. At some point, man, they snap, you know?
No, this is all true. And the last observation I'm going to offer about this, because I want to get to the topic at hand, actually,
yeah,
which will tie to this discussion a little bit. But what's interesting here is that you're entirely correct that, you know, Andy Warhol's hyper analogy is now fully in play. But what's weird is that because of the isolation that has been provided, and it's weird because you have this greater level of communication available to you. You can talk to people from around the world, and you and I have done that for sure. You know, we wound up talking to people in Australia. Now, how many people would we be talking to in Australia in a pre-internet age? Probably nobody, unless they happen to show up in our local area for some odd reason, you know, visiting family near us, nearby where we live or something, right? There's a lot of different ways to look at it, but, you know, at the same time, it's also increased this sensitivity. So some people cannot take being challenged about their assertions or their alleged status or whatever it is that they somehow believe because they've gotten some confirmation from an automated system somewhere. It's very weird. It's like, how dare you let your virtual reality interfere with my virtual reality? I mean, it's all a game and it's all a simulation anyway. And at the end of the day, you know, yeah, we do have to self-promote. I get that. And it's not a matter of being a narcissist or whatever, but, I mean, you want people to hear what it is that you're producing. But at the same time, you're right. Also, we can also predict, and you and I have actually done this, where it's like, you know, I think this person is in trouble and we're about to see something here. And every single time one of us says that to the other, what happens, Daniel?
Flip out and just chaos. It's chaos to the point to where I guess it's like a warning signal to people like you and me. Okay, it's time to unplug from the internet because it's weird, dude. Especially with the texting age, because people get pissed off at you when you text stuff based off the emotions they're feeling when they read your text. You know, and it's nowhere near what you meant. People just, I don't know, it's the internet and technology is a double-edged sword. you know, it really is. But yeah, me and you can pretty much bet when some quote personality is just about to go off the rails, man. 9 times out of 10 we're correct. Or we're just like early.
Yeah, maybe a touch early, but not too much. And look, the text thing is a perfect analogy because here's what the problem is. Again, it is not what was done to the individual that really causes the offense or the flip out session usually. It is what they brought into the situation and how they've now interpreted something that could be interpreted several ways. In other words, when somebody is reacting like negatively to something that's been texted to them or, you know, has this seriously visceral reaction to somebody else's creation online or somebody else's meme and they get hateful and they get threatening and they get all these different, you know, jacked up sort of emotions, it usually tells you a lot more about what they had stirring long before somebody put another image in front of them or a couple of characters, you know, in the language of the day. It's irrelevant. It's all about what they brought into the situation. And with that, we're going to turn to Infinity War.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. You and I went to the theater together. This is a comic-based movie, sure, and some people are going to say, oh, here they go. They're going to get silly with the comic books. But I got to tell you that there's a bit of background to this that I think we should quickly lay out to give people an idea that this has a lot more to do with, to me, psychology, sociology, and spirituality than might be easily gleaned by the average moviegoer at first glance. And what do you think? Should we give them a little bit of the background related to the story of Infinity War?
Well, I intended, like, use spoilers tonight, so if you guys hadn't seen Infinity War by now, I'm sorry, but $26 million later, you've seen it. I mean, you know, people who would say that, oh, they're talking about comic book movies or whatever, look, as opposed to what, politics right now? Which is more dignified at this point? Do you really think I want to pay attention to the cartoon that is politics and geopolitics? It's more fiction than what you're getting at the cinemas. So, you know, I'm just of the belief that I'm not one of these people who are like, when they look at movies, that thinks that they're it's satanic messages that are coming from a shadowy cabal that all, you know, they primarily hate Christians. Let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. Every symbolic Hollywood movie is about, you know, mocking Christianity, isn't it? I mean, how paranoid do you have to be? I don't believe that, like, there are satanic messages or that the symbolism that we see in Hollywood, which is now becoming ever increasingly obvious. I mean, you can get on YouTube and you can find hundreds of, you know, Doctor Strange decoded or Marvel Universe decoded. And I think that's a really, really good thing. And you got a good swath of people out there who are still in fear mode. Like they're waking up to the greater reality. And so they're still in the mindset that there is an us and a them, or that there's like some omnipotent, omnipresent entity or group, you know, that is planning all these Hollywood movies and they're putting satanic messages in there or occultic messages in there.
You know, and here's what it speaks to for me, and I always get myself in trouble with a certain portion of the listeners. I think I've chased most of them away by now, but there's a certain portion of the listeners I used to have that, quite honestly, saw that there was... this is in their mind, this is not my thought, saw that there was a war against Christianity in general. It's very much the thing that's pushed by, you know, Fox News, who constantly claims that they're not, you know, mainstream news, but they are. They're just, you know, a different flavor over there at the Baskin and Robbins of idiocy. But the thing is, you know, it's all ice cream, baby. It's all the same stuff. It's just got a little bit of a different flavor so that, you know, you'll be happier. You'll go back to the memories of that old flavor and keep ordering the same thing. So the thing is, there's a lot of people that feel as though Christianity in general is in the crosshairs of, you know, everything from Islam to the rest of the world, you know, that the adversary is constantly at them, and that the survival of all Christians is a daily miracle because of all of the enemies poised against them. And I find that fascinating, that level of paranoia, because it leads to this idea, like, let's just take the Muslims, for instance, which always...
Well, let me ask you, do you think that's true, though, Chuck, as somebody who's a pagan and somebody who observes society, do you, I mean, honestly, do you believe that the world at large or the secular world is attacking Christianity?
Well, no. No, I don't. And okay. Here's the reason why. If the world at large were to be attacking Christianity, as I understand it, here's your problem. Let's just deal with the Muslims. Okay, forget about me as somebody who's outside of the, Abrahamic traditions and all that. Forget about all those who call themselves atheists, which also are an affront to Christians, according to them. But forget about all that stuff, which, by the way, atheists generally, I really don't think that atheists exist. They just have lower levels of gods that they adhere to, because quite often they think the government is God. But anyway, now let's get to it. The thing is that Muslims, if they wanted to wipe out Christians from the planet, they outnumber you 7-1, Christians. I mean, it is so easy to have destroyed Christianity in various areas on the globe, which they claim all the time. They are doing it. They're doing it. There's no proof of this, because generation after generation, Christians have continued to survive in areas where they're in minorities all across the planet. Now, does that say that on occasion there are not campaigns to wipe out Christians or to wipe out Jews or to wipe out Muslims or to wipe out, secular people or to wipe out, Wiccans or pagans or what? In different areas at different times, because of hyperbolic rhetoric, there are indeed campaigns that take place. Is this a worldwide phenomenon? Or is this a tribal reaction, which is usually driven by mass hysteria? There is your question, and it's usually relegated to a region, an area, a particular place. You know, the Salem witch trials, the Inquisitions, all of these things were localized to a particular area. You know what I'm saying? And every time one of these campaigns gets loosed, it does happen that particular groups are certainly put under the gun of somebody else because of their belief system or lack thereof. But the idea that the entire world is turned against any one particular faith or group of individuals all at the same time, I do not find this to be real. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that, one of the mind-controlling mechanisms of organized religion is martyr syndrome or victim syndrome. It's like they always, in just about every religion that you study, if it's a religion, not a faith, okay, and you know my opinions on the differences between spirituality and religion, but one of the things that religious institutions do is they say, you'll know that that what you're doing is correct in our religion because people will persecute you. But then, like, whenever they go to define persecution, it's basically when anybody disagrees with what you believe, you're being persecuted. And I'm like, no, that's not persecution. Look, I've been through organized religion in the Southern Baptist Church and all that good stuff. And so I know what, quote, persecution is as a Christian. And then as my spirituality evolved into other things, which goes across the gambit, I could tell you that in my experience, I'm not saying it's across the board, everybody's got a different experience, but in my experience, the institution that persecutes others the most is Christianity. Now, I'm not making a slam against the person of Christ or the Bible. I'm talking about the people who call themselves mainstream Christians. In my experience, I have felt more persecution from those people than anybody else any day of the week, and twice on Sunday when I was a Baptist.
Well,
okay.
See, now here's the fun part about this, right? You actually have a background as, you taught Sunday school even. You see this as, Christians, generally those who identify themselves as Christians are usually the persecutor as opposed to the person being persecuted. I think it's just based on your level of exposure. I don't even think that it's particularly prevalent among Christians. And this is because I have a different perspective, you understand. Yeah. It seems to me as though if you have an overwhelming majority of people in an area, and they seem to be the majority, they will often persecute the minority, and that goes across the board for whatever purposes they deem somebody to be part of a minority. Mm-hmm. That's it. And the other thing is that this interesting concept of disagreement for persecution, and everybody's going, well, I thought they were going to talk about the comic book. Don't worry, we're getting there.
We are, we're getting there.
Here's the thing. I remember when I was 6 years old. You're going to love this story real quick in like less than a minute. I'm 6 years old, and it was field day at my very, very poor sort of crappy school up in New Jersey, which they closed down 2 years later because it was falling apart, literally unsafe for kids to be in. But anyway, one of the kids that was there at the field day with me said, you know, are you sure you want to be in the sack race with me? And this was a thing where you did like a three-legged race thing, but you put a potato sack around, you know, each of your legs, and they were kind of bound together.
I know what it is, Chuck. I ain't that young.
Well, I'm just saying, listen, some people out there probably have no idea what we're talking about because they don't do this kind of stuff anymore because probably the schools get sued. But anyways, I'm in a regular public school, and this is what we were doing. And he says, you know, are you sure you want to be in the sack race with me because I am a Christian? And I was so stunned by this because I'm like, well, yes, so? What does that mean? Well, a lot of people don't like to be around me because I'm a Christian. And it struck me then, I'm 6 years old, that this kid had been taught by his parents that because he is a Christian, others will not want to be around him or intimate with him or involved with him.
Yeah.
Because this is a kid I saw every day. He never thought to think, but because I'm going to put my leg in the same sack with his, and we're both six-year-old boys, you know, this is a problem? Where did that even come from? I remember sitting there saying, this is the most silly thing ever. Let's just do this, man. You know,
yeah.
And we lost. But anyway, you know, the blind guy and the timid Christian trying to run a three-legged race. Yeah, it sounds like the beginning of a joke, and it was. But there you go. At Broadway School in Long Branch, New Jersey, this happened. And I remember the kid's name was Michael, and he was the most timid, interesting kid, but he went to church like three times a week. And I don't even remember what kind of Christian he was. But I remember that, and I remember being struck by the oddity of that. Like, are you sure you want to be anywhere near me? Because I'm a Christian. And I just thought to myself, at 6 years of age, your parents taught you this. And I don't know why. And I couldn't figure it out for many years, actually, Daniel.
Yeah, it's you guys were unequally yoked. Yeah, I mean, and I've had experiences. One of my first experiences were, you know, my parents didn't raise me in anything. They basically just said, figure it out, you know. But I remember at like first grade or something, there was a Jewish kid in the class, and on Easter holiday, you know, his parents came and got him out early. He couldn't have like the Easter party with us where you watch a movie and eat pizza or whatever. And I always thought that was odd. I was like, well, why is he going home? Why can't he stay for pizza and a movie? You know, oh, he has a different religion. And that, to me, that just struck me at a young age. Like, that's weird, you know. And there was, you know, even a girl that I was pretty smitten with, and we could never date because she was she was Jewish. And it never made sense to me. It really never made sense to me. And it wasn't until, like, I started opening myself up to different spiritual schools, especially when you branch out into paganism, or, you know, belief structures that have more than one deity, which is really where the Avengers is going to take place, because it really deals with the idea of monotheism versus polytheism. It really, really does. It's ironic that we did that show on Israel, and because of all the fever pitch in Israel, which is your monotheistic religions keeping that area of the world in utter chaos, this Islam and Christianity and Judaism, it's those three world religions that are making that place such a hot spot for violent activity. But anyway, I digress.
Well, that's okay, because you know what? This leads perfectly into where I would like to go right now. And Infinity War features a character named Thanos, okay? Now, this you can find this, again, you're going to hear plenty of spoilers about it, and if you have read the comic book or haven't read the comic book or have seen the movie or haven't, you're going to hear part of the story as we go here. And there's a significance to just the name of the character. What is it? Okay, well, first of all, it is it basically comes from the Greek word for death. Okay, which, you know, I forget exactly how it's pronounced, but it's like Thanatos or something like this. And that's really what it means. Okay, now in the Marvel comic book universe, Thanos had a brother named Eros. Now, why is this interesting? Well, if you take a look at, like, say, the work of Sigmund Freud and things like that, you'll find that Thanos versus Eros is something that is a concept, is a paradigm within Freud's work and within various other philosophers' work, and what does it mean? Well, Eros leads to the concept of life. Thanos, or Thanatos, whatever, leads to death. And they are constantly in a tug of war with one another in these different paradigms. Why? Because, after all, things die and things are replaced and life comes in. And, in fact, if you take a look at the natural world, I mean, plants die, they go into the ground, they do what? Nourish other plants to rise up. You know, individuals, they give birth to children, they age, they die, they go away. Those children then age, have other children, you know, cycles of life, circles of life, whatever it is you want to describe it as. Okay, now this is an interesting thing, not necessarily what it's all about, but the Thanos character being named the way he is in the Marvel Universe in the movies, kind of significant in that, you know, his goal here, which is introduced pretty quickly in the movie, okay, when he is already on his way to seizing some of these Infinity Stones. Okay. Thing about the Infinity Stones is they have a particularly interesting representation in my mind, and I'm going to give my observation about this, and I'm going to turn it over to you and let you take this further. And I actually had to write them down so I could remember exactly how they worded it, but I do believe that one of them is the Power Stone, one of them is the Space Stone, one is the Reality Stone, one is the Soul Stone, then there is the Time Stone and the Mind Stone. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if we think very carefully, these six aspects are actually, in an esoteric sense, represented in the pentacle because there are six compartments in the five-pointed star. And you could literally place each of these things in those compartments and get yourself a well-rounded concept of all things which are powerful and are causes in the universe itself. Okay? And that's an interesting way to look at it, but there's a lot of ways to look at this, isn't there, Daniel?
Well, there's a ton of it. And what I was saying before you so rudely interrupted me with that brilliant monologue, what I started to notice when I got into circles where people acknowledge more than one deity or more than one aspect of deity, like, for example, you and me, right? You know that I've been really studying my Celtic and Druid roots, and I've been looking at their pantheon. And me and you talk about the syncretism of all the different pantheons, where basically you and I could sit down and discuss our different deities or different entities that we work with, communicate with, whatever. And there's no disagreement or argument or contention between, say, you and I, or say, you and Sherry, or some other people who are in the esoteric circles. But we don't really argue about it. We just basically try to find commonalities between our different schools of spirituality. You know what I'm saying?
Well, right. Now, the only confusion comes up occasionally where we have different names for something, but we're usually describing the same thing. Which I always find fascinating, and this is usually part of the great learning process where it's like, oh, so when I'm talking about, you know, this particular entity, I mean, let's take one of the most easy ones and often repeated ones, the God of War.
Yeah.
Is represented in just about every religion there is, one way or another. Now, sometimes it's given to this singular idea of the adversary, right? The Satan character, which obviously sounds very similar to Saturn and all that kind of good stuff. But in multi or polytheistic circles, there's various names for the God of War, but they all come together and sort of coalesce into the same guy, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the same thing with Christ figures in different schools of thought. But, and whenever you and I went to go see the Infinity War, it took me a minute, you know, and I'll talk like a geek here in a minute about the movie, but, it, you know, because there was so much in it. And you got to understand something. Marvel, oh, it was just a few years ago, they were about to go bankrupt, Chuck. And then out of nowhere, now it's like this juggernaut in cinema, in Hollywood. And, you know, they have taken over a decade, 10 years, starting with Iron Man. And God knows how much money. I mean, how much does Robert Downey Jr., how much does he charge for a movie now? And he's in most of these movies. And he's just one of the main actors. So you know that the people who are behind this series of movies, they're not like absent-minded on what they're doing. It's very intentional because they have put more money and resources behind this MCU universe than you and I can ever calculate. So, and you don't just do something like that. You don't get a huge amount of people in all areas of their craft, whether it be cinematography or digital design or acting or script writing or whatever. You don't assemble this many people over a 10-year period in like 19 movies leading up to one movie just willy-nilly. There is a design there. Now, what I was saying earlier about I don't believe that it's like a cabal of people putting occult messages in there, what I mean is, just like in every age, our theater, our creativity, the way that we're expressing ourselves as artists in every way is a result of what's happening on the subconscious collective consciousness. You know, we're feeding ourselves these stories, and when we start to see esoteric messages, really what we're doing is we're looking into a mirror of what we see within ourselves, because as above, so below, as without, so within. So I find it ironic that people who do tend to look at the symbolism, and especially these movies, as evil or dark or satanic or anti-anything, it really speaks more about what they're seeing within themselves rather than truth. Because you and I could go see Avengers Infinity War, and we did, and both of us can walk away with different interpretations of what this film meant. Like, for example, to you, Tony Stark represents the military-industrial complex, and to me, I see him as a King David-type figure, which matches up, really, because King David was a man of war, right? So, right. Really, it's a real Carl Jung type thing when it comes to decoding the Marvel Universe, you know, and it's like that these movies are really the symbolism that you see as a Rorschach. It's what you're seeing within yourself.
Well, right, and let me just go after something here real quick, which I know we're not going to touch on much during this show, but I want to enter it here. There is the sociological and psychological aspects here, which are seemingly disconnected from the esoteric that one could observe as well. Like, you don't have to go into this thinking, okay, so I'm going to see all these crazy symbols and I got to decode all this. Quite honestly, you can see society, you can see the cycle of life, the circles of life being played out on the screen as well. You see the younger generation coming in and being treated a certain way by the established individuals one way or another. You see the struggle between the establishment and those that are sort of on the fringes of the establishment but are actually serving the purposes of others, right? You see individuals attempting to deal with their own psychological or emotional wounding one way or another. You can see this in a lot of different ways, and you don't even have to, even for a moment, dip into the conventional sort of spiritual stuff or get into the deep esoteric. You could see a lot of themes here, and it's multi-layered, I think, purposely.
Oh yeah.
So that it produces the effect that you're describing, which is this Rorschach test where, you know, listen, it's an ink blot. Okay.
It is.
But it's a well-designed ink blot to allow you to see what it is that you already have in your own mind. And that's what you're going to wind up articulating. And because I've taken so much time with the military-industrial complex, that's the thing that goes to the top of my mind regarding the Tony Stark character, right? We could also look at him as, if I were more focused on transhumanism stuff, he has a combination between technology and humanity, which is presented to various ends, literally, physically, with an implant in his body, but also the utilization and the marriage between man and machine. So that, plus the generational struggle, plus the sort of a surrogate father figure role he plays with Spider-Man. There's all kinds of stuff going on here, and you could take this in as many different directions as I believe you could have individuals sitting in a theater all at once. And here's the fun part. I don't think any of them are wrong.
No, they're all right. They're all right. But I would just note that if you, there's a clip that I sent to you earlier, I want you to play here shortly, because it's the example of how I think that is a poor way to go into interpreting things like this, but we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, you can draw so many, and one of the things that you and I discussed afterwards was, for, you know, all these movies over 10 years, all this money, to intertwine, all of these stories intertwine. Anybody who's a big Marvel buff knows that. One movie connects to another movie. At first, like during phase one of Marvel, most people didn't catch on. You know, even I was a little late to it. I was like, wait a second, they're weaving together an entire universe, just like the comic books. When I was a kid, nobody's ever done this before, you know, in cinema. Nobody's ever taken this big of a risk. And, you know, so all of it is weaving into this movie, Infinity War. It's like if there's ever any subconscious message that we as humans are sending to ourselves, it has got to be somewhere in this film, right? And what's the premise of the movie? Thanos, which is this titan, you know, over a period of however many centuries or whatever, he has the agenda, which is completely different from the comic books, but that's okay. He is absolutely convinced, based off of his own personal experience, that in order to keep balance in the universe, that 50% of the population has to go. And obviously this smacks of what's going on in you know, the New World Order with the depopulation thing. And anybody listening to your show is already well educated on all that stuff, that there's a, you know, a very big push that there's too many people on this planet, even though everyone on this planet could fit like in Florida, you know, comfortably. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And we have the Georgia Guidestones here to talk about keeping the population under. So you have this titan, this guy who wants to be God, that is utterly convinced that if he can pull together the six singularities of the universe, that the best course of action to maintain balance for the greater good is the hardest decision that no one else, you know, seems to be willing to make, and that doesn't make him insane, is to wipe out half the life in the universe. And so, you know, that's kind of the premise. And if you really pay attention to it, yeah, we got like all the Avengers, the original Avengers, the Secret Avengers, the new Avengers, all those Avengers were thrown into this movie. But Chuck, which character in the movie actually went through Joseph Campbell's hero's journey?
Well, the best that I can see here is that it's actually the guy who is initially thought of to be the villain.
Thanos.
Because... Yeah. And here's the thing, he's not a villain because in his mind, what he's doing is a random genocide of 50%. Okay, which means that all of the resources will now be distributed again, you know, to the half that is still left alive, and they will thrive. And he even points to having done this in one particular place and saying, now that place where people were starving and there were problems and there were things is a thriving, wonderful society that's all well and good.
It's a Garden of Eden.
Yeah. It's become a utopia, right? Where everything is thriving now because half of the population got to go.
Yeah.
You know, and there are people that justify. And here's the interesting thing about him, too, is that it's not necessarily about a particular type of people. He's not demonizing. You know, like say, this color people or these people who believe something or people of a certain, intellectual level need to go because they're just not, you know, worthy of surviving. It's not a eugenicist plot. It's a matter of just numbers. Okay. Cold, calculated. Here's what it is. And the reason why half of everything needs to die is because that other half that gets to live will thrive.
Yeah. And he's utterly convinced of it, and he you know, he's not a, you know, they did the role of the villain in this movie perfectly, which is to write a good villain, the villain has to absolutely positively believe that they're the hero of the story, and they did a really good job with it, because he really, really does. He believes that his course of action is the right course of action, and it comes down to whose will is more powerful. Is it going to be his and the Black Order, or is it going to be the Avengers, you know, and the Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever? It comes down to will. And we know the old occult mantra there, right? But So in the movie, yeah, he's the only one that takes the hero's journey. You know, so that we could really empathize with why he wants to do what he wants to do. But we also have 10 years of backstory with all of these others who in their own right, and if you go through every single Marvel movie, like Thor, all of his titles, the Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, each one of them in their movies play the messianic figure of their movies. And they're even, it's blatant to the point of whenever you and I did the Spider-Man show of showing you Spider-Man in the crucified position. But every single one of them play a Christ or Messiah role in their own individual stories. So when I stepped back and looked at the movie, I said, what is this? What we're seeing is a conflict between a bunch of Christs or Christ figures who all have to come together, and all of them have different skill sets, different abilities, they come from different places, to go up against this one entity, right? And when you take that layer away, it comes back to what we were discussing previously, which is this, is it really a conflict between Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, or is there another conflict that's probably more important, which is polytheism versus monotheism? And, you know, after deep reflection and seeing the movie three times, I said, okay, is what Marvel trying to tell us, is it something that's going on now, or is it something that's going to come? But then, of course, the first thing that I really could lay over was the Old Testament. And, of course, my opinion of the Old Testament is far different from most Orthodox Christians, which is the Old Testament, you know, in this aspect is a monotheistic God waging war with pantheons of different cultures across the world. It's one guy waging war on, I guess, what you would call the old gods. And, you know, that's kind of how the Old Testament ends, is with this monotheistic guy who says he's God, but requires a lot of very nasty things, you know. Like you talk about the Abrahamic religion, and we have to keep in context the Abrahamic religions. Let me get this straight. The Abrahamic religions are based off of the notion that there was a guy who had a son, and in order for this guy to prove his unwavering fidelity to this very clearly sane God, is to put him through the trauma of taking his son up to a rock and cutting his throat or stabbing him or sacrificing him, right?
Now, well, yeah, wait 1 second now, because here's the thing, though. This is key. Not only was it his son, but it was his favored son.
Yeah.
Now, so in other words, he had to offer up not only, you know, one of his children, because he had many, right? But this was his favorite one, the one that he had to wait for, even, yes?
No, like it was the promised one, yeah, that he had with Sarah. And right. So it's like, well, wait a second, okay. Let me get this straight. I mean, what kind of a entity, what kind of a, quote, God, is going to do that to his friend, okay? Who's going to do that? Hey, you got to go kill your son. And I, you know, you'll hear people, oh, he didn't really, you know, remember the angel stopped him. You don't think that dude was absolutely traumatized, if you take the story literally and historically. You don't think that Abraham was like going through some PTSD up until the point where this angel stopped him. I mean, even that is screwed up for a deity to request of his follower. Don't you think?
Well, again, you know, with the backstory of making him wait so long for this child, which is promised, and nearly having him abandon all hope that he's even going to have the child, then, now I know you've got this treasured child from your favorite wife. I now want you to take, I mean, if you think about it, that's like, you know, show me that you are willing to throw everything away and become the emptiness in order to appease me. I mean, that's a pretty demanding God.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not a guy to have over for coffee, you know, but I mean, that's your Abrahamic religions. And, you know, and somehow or another, they connect this entity that basically goes by the name Jahweh or Jehovah, into the God of the New Testament. But, you know, if you look at it analytically, look, dude, if you honestly think that Yeshua or Jesus is the God of the Old Testament, you are like, you need to get your head out of your ass and you need to actually read the book. And you will never, ever, 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 if you read the Old Testament and then read the New Testament, you can never logically, without some pastor or preacher or whatever telling you that that's the God of the Prince of Peace, you'll never make that connection if you just read the story. Okay? So, you know, if you look at the Old Testament, I believe, because obviously in Infinity Wars, spoiler, you know, the movie is, it was, when I first saw it, I was disturbed by a lot of different things. And obviously the ending of it, which we can always backtrack, but the ending of it is this story ends with Thanos winning and wiping out 50% of the population and most of the old gods or the Avengers. He just snaps his fingers and he wins. And then credits roll, brother.
Well, and, wait, because there's a couple of things need to be entered here. Not only does he wipe out a lot of the Avengers, a lot of the old gods, as you said, but he wipes out the next generation of them.
Yeah.
Across the board, which is like, you know, okay, so I'm going to leave you with the guys that are in, you know, their middle ages or, you know, nobody knows exactly how old Captain America is, but, you know, I'm going to leave you the old guys. I'm not going to even leave you the next generation of heroes. They basically evaporated. And so there was that going on. That's another thing that happens, by the way. They just sort of fly away, you know, which I don't
but
know how you
raptured, want. Like a rapture.
Like a rapture, but like a rapture combined with the scenes from the old Terminator movies where people would get, you know, blown away into ash by the nuclear blast, except yeah. There's no nuclear blast and they're just gone.
Yeah, and like you could feel how it disturbed the audience, and you know, look, dude, come on, man, they spent a lot of money on this movie, spent a lot of time, and it, like I told you, and I've told other people, I said for the younger kids who have followed these movies for 10 years or so, this is going to traumatize them, right? Because the Jehovah character or the monotheistic God character, he wins, and all of the up-and-coming gods that are kind of being trained and honed by the old gods, which would be the original lineup of Avengers, they're all gone, right? And to me, that just smacks so much of the Old Testament. You know, this is the Old Testament. If you really go back and look at it, when we talk about Jehovah or the Lord God or whatever, you know, he's a very jealous God. You know, he tells you that over and over again. And it's like, jealous of who? And if you pick up the Gnostic Gospels, you know, that's actually how a lot of the angels rebelled, is whenever he proclaimed that he was a jealous God, these angels kind of looked at each other and said, well, who's he jealous of? Who the hell's, you know, why would he be jealous of if there is no other ones, right? So this Jehovah character is a jealous God. He's a wrathful God, a vengeful God, and he's convinced that he's right. You know, and it, obviously this movie smacks of so much Gnosticism because, you know, in the Gnostic text it does talk about how Jehovah is actually Yaldabaoth, which is the insane God, you know, the God that was aborted by Sophia. And as it became conscious, it was in a cloud of darkness and it actually believed that it was the only God, you know. And that it created the material world, and when it discovered that there in fact was other gods, it started to do some damage control of the material world. And that's, you know, kind of where the book of Genesis would pick up. But, I mean, when I looked at the Infinity War, I said, oh my God, this is talking about, the end of the old gods. It's talking about the war on the Egyptian gods of, you know, in the Old Testament. And so, what is Marvel trying to say to us? You know, now, presently, currently, you know, and it's thankfully because of the internet, people like you and me and people around the world have been able to expose each other of our different cultures and come to the realization, those of us who aren't religiously propagandized, come to the realization that we, you know, Hindus and Buddhists and really what Christ actually taught has more in common than we were told by religious institutions. You know, we actually have more in common with, you know, if you talk to a Hindu, you know, and they say, look, we don't really believe this multiplicity of gods are actually, it's all allegory. It's an allegory about the self. All these, whenever I sit down to meditate and I have a statue of Buddha, I know that that piece of ceramic, clay is not God. Okay? It's not idolatry. It's a point of meditation to reflect on the inner Buddha. Or when Hindus do it in front of a statue of Kali or a statue of Shiva, they're not actually worshiping that piece of bronze. This is a misconception that organized religion puts on you, that they're worshiping the object. And that's silly if you actually have a conversation with them. And they say, no. This is to make me reflect on the aspect of God within me through this archetype, which is what most polytheists or pagans will tell you, is that they don't actually believe in Baphomet and Zeus and Thor and all these things. They believe that those archetypes help them to hone in on themselves and the divinity within themselves, right? Am I babbling, or does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I've got a little bit of a bone to pick with you about the Tony Stark character, just a bit, but all of this makes a tremendous amount of sense. Now, Thanos is not really a jealous, he's very even-tempered, it seems like. You know, and that's the weird thing going forward with him, because we're seeing this from his perspective, which is something that is not provided to you in, you know, listen, when you take a look at, the stories of the Old Testament, you're not getting it from God's perspective, from the God's perspective that's, you know, commanding, you know, this sacrifice of the favored son and all that. That's not happening. So this is a unique lens on the same story. Now we're almost out of time in the first hour, believe it or not. Okay. And, I'm not sure exactly which direction you want to go in. I mean, I'm not sure how long it would take to pick at the Tony Stark character just a minute. Because, here's the thing about that. He loses his surrogate son. He is definitely afflicted with a great many things, nearly killed, and in fact, Doctor Strange, who is a pivotal character in this movie.
I think he's the most important character.
Well, he's one of them, but he is one of a handful of characters who actually go against their own belief system by, you know, because over and over we hear in the movie, we're not going to trade lives. We're not going to trade one life for another. And yet that reoccurs a few times. They try not to do it and then seem to get stuck in a place where they end up doing it. But let's continue on with the Doctor Strange part. Doctor Strange goes and takes a look at 1 million possibilities or something like this.
14,605.
I'm sorry, 14,600. See, he remembers the exact number, I don't. But whatever it is, it's kind of irrelevant once you get into the millions of possibilities and outcomes. And here's the thing, when he says, well, gee, and how many of those do we win? I think Tony Stark asks him. And he says, one. Now, being that he has that knowledge, I find it very interesting that he literally surrenders the Time Stone to Thanos, which to me suggests that Strange has the knowledge that somehow this will create a winning scenario. Now, as far as what we see on the screen, that's not what happens. But then again, the story's not quite complete, is it?
No.
So
gotta have a New Testament.
Well, you gotta have a New Testament. But here's the thing about the Stark character. With all the things he's been afflicted with, and with the amount of faith that he now has to put into things, and again, even losing, Peter Parker is vaporized. So Spider-Man's gone. Right? So are a bunch of other younger people and interesting individuals across the board. A lot of what I would consider to be the new generation of the Marvel superheroes, you know, those messianic figures, right, yeah, are removed from the equation. Seems like something's wrong there, not only because of the different esoteric aspects here, but let's just think about this from a purely entertainment standpoint. There's a lot of sequels and things that could be made out of those guys. And,
yeah,
you know,
it
seems,
yeah,
like we're definitely being set up for a story that is still incomplete. But Tony Stark almost comes off as a Job-like character because, well, you know, we gotta make sure that this guy has faith, and I bet you he'll lose his faith if he loses this, and if he loses that, and if he loses the third thing. Well, He is afflicted with the boils. He's now dealt with the plague. Okay, he's dealt with the loss of his kingdom, so to speak. He's dealt with the loss of his surrogate son. He's dealt with all of that, and he is left there now at the end of the movie, reaping all of it, and now his faith needs to be tested. I figure that comes up in the next part. So I almost think he's Job in the esoteric sense here when you take a look at the allegory. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Job is a big allegory that fits all Christ figures when they go through the dark night of the soul. You know, so Job can be wrapped up into the prologue of any Christ figure. But I think, like, for those of us who are looking at it, Marvel wanted to make absolutely sure that we understood that the Christ figure of this particular saga is supposed to be Tony Stark in some way or the other. I mean, look, the poster shows him in the form of the cross with the heart chakra lit up. And, he, you know, at the end of it, whenever we think he's going to, you know, bite the big one, he gets the spear to his side by this monotheistic God, right? And, you know, that's when we all think he's Job, he's lost everything, but he's supposed to be the Christ of this story.
Well, but here's the interesting part with Doctor Strange. Because Strange, who wasn't going to surrender that stone under any circumstance and was going to use every trick in the book that he could, which, by the way, Strange has plenty of tricks to offer, was willing to surrender that stone under one condition, wasn't he?
Yeah, if Stark survived. And see, I never did any type of a Doctor Strange breakdown because I don't know. Doing that to me just seems a little dangerous because there's so much truth in Doctor Strange that if black magic screwabouts really could break it down, it would cause some havoc. But I think another aspect that they were trying to show us was, you know, the Bible talks about the Son of Man and the Son of God and this duplicitous role of the Messiah. Because Jesus, or Yeshua, is also separate from Christ, right? Like if you do look at the New Testament, you see that when he goes around and he heals people, raises people from the dead, he is drained of energy, and he has to kind of go off and replenish his spiritual batteries or whatever. But I think that one of the things they were trying to show us is that Tony Stark and Dr. Stephen Strange are also two sides of the same coin, especially even down to the goatee. Like, they both had almost identical goatees. And there's a point whenever the Avengers are on Titan and they're fighting Thanos that Doctor Strange goes into total Shiva. You know, he basically makes copies of himself. But they're throwing it in your face that at that point, Doctor Strange is representing Shiva. Now, Shiva is the glorified or, you know, super form of Krishna. Right? Krishna would be considered, the Son of Man, the human part of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And, Shiva would be the glorified. Whereas Yeshua or Jesus was a man, but we also see scenes of him in a glorified or super state. So what you're seeing is in Hinduism you have Krishna and Shiva, two sides of the same coin. In Christianity you have Yeshua the man, the Son of Man, and the Son of God. And then superimpose Infinity War, you would also see that Tony Stark and Dr. Stephen Strange are also two heads of the same coin. And Stark would be a David, a man of war, you know, the manly, the human part of the Messiah. And then, of course, Dr. Strange is his glorified form. That's kind of what I saw. And even to kind of show you that they were doing this binary stuff in the movie, when you get back to Earth at the last fight, it's passed off as a joke, but it's more esoteric than people think. Whenever Thor is on the battlefield with Captain America, Steve Rogers, which Thor, we can get into Norse mythology and the old gods there, they make it a point to point out, you know, Thor says, "I see that you've copied my beard." And it's like that line, yeah, it's a funny one-liner. But it was that they were pointing out something about facial hair, both on Wakanda with Thor and Steve Rogers and on Titan with Tony Stark and Dr. Stephen Strange. So you have a binary of binaries going on. Does that make any kind of sense, or am I way too medicated?
No, I think you're making perfect sense. However, we've gone over the 1 hour point, and I want to take a break here. I think this is a good spot to take a break because we have now really gone in pretty deep, actually, into the area I wanted to go in. And meanwhile, this does not negate any of the points that I brought up earlier, the generational struggle, the concept of you just look at it as pure entertainment. I mean, there is a whole lot of story arcs all seeming to, you know, come together in one particular point. They're all going to have a trajectory that lands in one spot. And I find that interesting that there's going to be this unifying parallels coming together on multiple levels. And in some cases, it's certainly two-sided coins. But there's a lot of dimensions to this. Wouldn't you agree?
Huh. Well, we're not ever going to be able to go through all of it. It'll be fun to try.
Well, that's true, and we are going to try. I'm going to take a short break here, but we'll be right back here at Ocelli.com. We're discussing Infinity War with Daniel Lewis Crumpton from DownloadedContent.com. And, hey, you know what? It's going to get a lot deeper. Stick around. Second hour beginning a little late here at Ocelli.com, but don't worry, we do have time to go into an after effect. So this show will probably be longer than 2 hours, but if you're catching the podcast, well, you'll just have to be a member at my Patreon page, or you'll have to be a member at Ocelli.com in order to get the after effect. Anyway, Daniel Lewis Crumpton is with me, and we are discussing Infinity War. And quite honestly, we could probably devote a full 2 hours to just the Infinity Stones themselves, which are these interesting things that wind up fitting into the Infinity Gauntlet worn by Thanos in the movie. We've certainly covered this a bit, but got deep into the esoteric context of the entire movie right away. Also, I've tried to enter into the discussion a few pieces about the sociology and psychology, which are there on the surface, that somebody who has absolutely no spiritual mindset whatsoever could take away from these movies as well. They are crafted to have multiple levels of meaning and are certainly the Rorschach test that we have been discussing thus far. So with that in mind, Daniel, we were pretty deep on the discussion about the old gods and the new gods and the old generation and the new generation and what, you know, the real problems are, the hero's journey of the seeming villain that's really the protagonist of the story. Because after all, any good villain is the hero in their own story, in their own mind, generally, if they're well written. And, Thanos is one of these characters. So where should we go from here?
Well, what you mentioned earlier about the theme, like the overarching theme of this particular movie is that we don't trade lives, or, you know, the needs of the many don't outweigh the needs of the one. You know, all of the Avengers fail because they are not willing to sacrifice an individual for the collective. You know, whether it's Scarlet Witch or Captain America, they're not willing to do that. Except for Doctor Strange, perhaps. But then when rubber meets the road, we find he doesn't even do that. Like he says it, but he doesn't do it. But the victor of the story is Thanos, because he's willing to do the one thing that none of the heroes are willing to do, and it's sacrifice somebody that he loves, the only person that he loves, really.
Okay, now let me enter into this discussion here, because I found this fascinating, and once again, the idea that you have somebody going to a mountain and possibly sacrificing their favorite son, gee, mm-hmm. That's a recurring theme here, because on a mountain,
yeah,
Thanos is called upon by, ready for this one, the only seemingly sentient stone of the power stones here, the actual infinity stones of power, the soul stone. What does the soul stone demand for someone to be able to possess it? The sacrifice of the one that they love the most. And it turns out that Thanos has the adopted daughter, who he does truly love, who has turned against him, doesn't matter, he still loves her. Even though he met her while destroying and decimating half of the population of her planet, you know, so this is a clearly adopted, not part of the, you know, his generations necessarily, you know, not part of his family line exactly, but still, nevertheless, his most treasured offspring, so to speak. This is what he's asked to sacrifice. And
who also, who also has a biblical name, but, you know, there's that.
Well, there's always that, yeah. But, you know, and here we go, on a mountaintop. I mean, no, it's not, I'm gonna, you know, thrust a, sharp object into you at the command of a god. In fact, it is the soul stone, which makes this demand upon him. And he gives it just a bit of thought, realizes that it will be tremendous pain, and is willing to trade that life for the greater good without really any hesitation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds an awful lot like, what I was taught in Sunday school. Because I always thought, you know, even when I was a firm believer, you know, you're in institutional religions, you're, a great amount of fear is put on questioning common sense or asking common sense questions that you have about the Bible or that narrative. Like, when you have a thought that's, oh, I don't know, like, man, if I was God and I had an only begotten son, I think that as God, I could figure out a better way than sending my only begotten son down to get the shit kicked out of him, get his flesh peeled off of him, get him spit upon, called a demoniac, a drunk, a adulterer, all these things, and then nailed to a cross. Like, that's I think I could figure out a better way to guide humanity along or save humanity from its sins than murdering my child. You know, but when you're in institutional religions and you have those types of questions pop up, you immediately are kind of taught that's Satan and you need to take that thought in captivity of Christ, which means Christ means what we told you Christ means. And if it seems contradictory or bloodthirsty or morbid, that's just the devil in your head. All right.
So it's like, what's strange is they will also tell you that, and this is something that I've always found completely bizarre, and this is why I could never survive in these institutions, because it seems to me as though the devil himself does the very same thing, where the devil might command you to do something that seems illogical and everything else, and you're supposed to reject that and just simply know the difference between the disembodied voices, which is kind of funny because the soul stone, again, do we even know what its intent is? Do we know if it is a good power? Is it a neutral thing? I can't see it as being neutral when it's demanding a sacrifice.
The soul stone, okay, just for a little backstory, the soul stone is supposed to be the only conscious stone. And it, like, if you have it, according to Marvel Wiki or whatever it is, you can control the souls of anything living or dead. But this soul stone also has its own world within it called Soul World. And it, quickly, like an addict, once it gets, it sucks up a few souls, it wants more and more and more. And it really, really echoes, if anybody's looked up the hypostasis of the Archons from, you know, the Nag Hammadi library, that stone, it hungers for more souls. And it's very Gnostic. Very, very Gnostic. And I find it funny that Thanos has to, in order to obtain that stone, has to give it, you know, this, person that he loves so much. It's wild, dude. It's a wild thing that Marvel put in here, whether intentionally or unintentionally, that talks about our roots that we are rediscovering. You know, I say since 1947, a lot of this information about what was really going on around the time of Christ and what the early, quote, Christians really believed is more akin to paganism than what monotheistic institutions have given us. So it's like, to me, you know, that's what this movie is pointing us to. And
well,
there's got
to
be a reason.
What's interesting to me, too, is that not only when you know, you go to obtain this thing, is it now, you know, first of all, the initial thirst, if you will, is quenched with that very significant offering of a soul. But how about all of those that are now going to be destroyed? Half of the population of not just Earth, mind you, but the universe now is now, with a snap of the fingers from the Infinity Gauntlet, can be destroyed just like that, sent to the rapture. So those souls, seems to me like, could be fed right into the soul stone and make it happy for, well, not very long, because, as you said, it seems to have this continuously cumulative thirst. So once you give it half of the universe's life, what comes next?
What more? So why are we being told to look at all these types of things? You know, I like the show that we did last week about Israel. You know, I think that it is making us come to grips with what we've been taught as spirituality, or what, where we've been putting our focus. And it's wild, man. I sent you a clip earlier, because I look at these movies and I say, this is supposed to be a reflection of us. And to me, I think that especially the Marvel movies, it's a retelling of the myths of old. And if you actually go back and you look at the myths of old, the cultures didn't believe in those. You know, like we said, they believed that they were archetypes about the journey inward. So we're supposed to be looking at how, what this particular movie is saying about us. And with the stones, yeah, we could go all over the stones, but I think that it's real close to the number of chakras, and I would purport that the seventh chakra would be the person who's wielding all six, who's trying to, you know, activate Kundalini or ascend or whatever you want to call it. And it just so happens that the person that gets the singularities from all aspects of reality in one universe happens to be very materialistic, very matter-based, right? Because, let's face it, me and you, the first thing that we said when we walked out of the theater was, dude, if you had the Infinity Gauntlet and your beef with the universe was that there were too many mouths and not enough food, why wouldn't you just as easily snap your fingers to create more food for the population? You know? Why wouldn't you do that? What kind of a mindset, what kind of a trauma does this entity, you know, that's basically, I mean, like, even in the beginning with the whole Loki and Thanos thing, he says, you'll never be a god. It's real clear what this movie is saying is this one individual is trying to get the power of the universe, even to the point where before Spider-Man bites the dust. You see what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
You see that?
Yep.
Bites the dust? Okay. He says, my god, right? And it's right at the point where the Avengers on Titan fighting this monotheistic god, when they're about to lose, you hear one of the characters say, my god. And then back on Earth, after the second half is completed and Thanos gets all the Infinity Gems, you hear Steve Rogers or Captain America say, my god. I mean, I think that's the last line of the movie, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
You know, that sounds about right. I'm trying to think, because there's a few things that go on after that, and I'm trying to think if there's any other words that are uttered, because I know we see a lot of other things after we hear that.
Yeah, so it's like I said, it's smacks of the Old Testament. I think, you know, one of the things that's real dangerous is propagating the perspective of looking at the symbolism in this movie as an assault on your spirituality. I think that's real dangerous. And the reason I say that is, you already know the clip that I'm going to ask you to play. But if we really look at the New Testament and the person of Christ and what his message was, it was that all of us are divine and that all of us could do just what he did and do more, and we're all just as important as, you know, he was. And, you know, even the term Christians, it means little Christ, like a bunch of them, right? And I think that what Marvel has done is it showed us this diverse swath and made us attracted to the idea of being our own hero, which is what Joseph Campbell was talking about. It's really what most spiritual paths are talking about, be the hero of your own story. But at some point you have to come face to face with this juggernaut, which I guess in Buddhist thinking would be like your ego, the dark half. This control freak inside of you. You know what I'm talking about, Chuck? Mm-hmm. You know, because you practice certain forms of magic, and you know that typically if you take on an apprentice or an understudy, eventually the power that they do get goes to their head and they go absolutely out of their gourd. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's always a time period of instability with someone that you're teaching intimately.
It gets disheartening.
Exactly right. It is very disheartening. Every time too. It's not, even though you know it's coming, to be honest with you, it's still a very tough thing to deal with.
Yeah, it's real disheartening. And they want the power of God. And you know, when I look at like the New Testament, here's a few things. Now, I'm not making any commentary on it. People can say whatever they want to say about what I'm saying, but it is what it is. When the person of Yeshua or Jesus or the Christ figure or the superhero of that world 2,000 years ago in that culture, when that archetype or allegory came face to face with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who were the priests, the guardians of this monotheistic Jehovah from the Old Testament, Yeshua or Jesus outright said that they worship the adversary Satan. So am I mistaken in interpreting that Jesus perceived the God of the Old Testament to be the devil? Am I mistaken or am I off there, Chuck?
No, I don't think you're off at all. And I gotta tell you that again, on the surface level, for people that sort of want to demonize immediately, the Disney Corporation, I feel your pain and I understand, because, you know, Disney's been involved in a lot of ridiculous things over the years and propaganda. And, although I feel as though, you know, some people take it a little too far, they have certainly had, factions within the corporation that have gone out of their way to put some pretty nefarious things out there for children to consume. Now, is this a children's movie? Not to my mind. It is not. But, you know, but so I understand that sort of reflex to a default position of, well, Disney's an evil corporation and therefore all of their products are going to be something. But that's the problem there. You see, it's not all about evil. Sometimes, my friends, a mouse is a mouse. You know, and they're not necessarily the archon of evil, as some people have represented them. I mean, what do you think about that, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, you're gonna get from it whatever it is you're supposed to be dealing with in yourself. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that being said, you know, when I read the New Testament, Chuck, and then I want you to play that clip, what I see is a Christ figure in a long line of Christ figures going back to Krishna and Shiva and Buddha and all that, confronting a priesthood in his day that basically were the progenitors of a war god, a sacrifice god, a god of blood and death, and, you know, go in there, take their land, kill them, kill their women, kill their children. I see this Messiah figure basically saying, your God is an asshole, and that is not the true God, right? So that being said, if you go to me, you and I have talked about it, I don't know if it was on the show last week or in private, but we talked about the fact that Yeshua, whenever he asked them, who do men say that I am, he was at Caesarea Philippi with the pagan, you know, the Greek pantheon or the Roman pantheon etched into the walls. But he didn't make a big deal about the pantheon, right? And later when Paul's on the scene and Paul goes to, you know, I think it's Mars Hill or something to preach, he sees the other pantheon of gods, you know, Zeus and all them, and they have a statue to the unknown God. And Paul kind of gets their attention and says, you know, I perceive you guys are superstitious. Let me preach unto you the unknown God. But Paul never bothers to say all your other gods are of the devil. He just says, here, let me talk to you about this deity that you hadn't met yet. And it says he preaches unto him Jesus, right? So it's like, to me, when I look at it, Yeshua traveled the world of the polytheistic world, understood the synchronicity between the different cultures, because we have records and, you know, evidence that this person, this historical person, Yeshua or Issa, traveled to places like Ireland and England and, you know, in Nepal and things like that. There's enough evidence. There's more evidence to believe that he traveled to those places than he was actually in Jerusalem. Let's just say that.
Well, there's even a place in China that is believed to be his final resting place by some people. Quite honestly, not where he was allegedly crucified either.
Yeah, so, you know, there's more evidence of that. And of course, I don't believe that the story that you read in the Bible is supposed to be taken as literal history, but I do believe it's true, and I believe it's based off of a real guy who could do some pretty cool stuff, at the turning of the age. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is I don't think that Yeshua had a problem with the idea of a multiplicity of aspects of the one true God, which is consciousness. I don't think he had a problem with it. I think that, as we spoke about on the show about Israel, when we got to, you have this Pharaoh Akhenaten that created monotheism in history. Like, you can actually prove that this guy lived, and he's the first person to come up with monotheism in recorded history. And then you compare that to the story of Moses. It's kind of obvious. And I don't know if – I think you and I have talked about this, but, you know, if you look back at the book of Exodus, the power or energy source that parted the Red Sea later parts the Jordan. And in the book of Joshua, it says that that same power source or technology was with them before they crossed the river, the Red Sea, but that was before they built the ark. And later you have them building the ark, and if you do the measurements and all this good stuff, there's a lot of research out there. It's real interesting. If you measure the Ark of the Covenant, it fits in the sarcophagus of the Great Pyramid. So there's all kinds of cool connections between Moses, monotheism, and Pharaoh Akhenaten and Atenism. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? There was a point in history where some dude, you know, just popped up in high civilization, in high culture, and said, your gods, they suck. You're all going to worship my gods now because I'm the Pharaoh. You know, Pharaoh Akhenaten, check him out. That's the beginning of monotheism, right?
Now, what's really terribly interesting here is a commonality from, ready for this, Thanos to Akhenaten, to all of them. Guess what it is? A seriously dark, traumatic thing that is devastating and isolates them.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating because, generally speaking, the people that are most hostile to these concepts where you begin discussing, you know, the multiple aspects of consciousness of, you know, the various gods as deities as represented, you know, in this way. The people that are most really terribly, viscerally reactive to it, they are generally, in history and also in everyday life, I find, Daniel, they are generally someone who has been isolated, separated, and traumatized at some point, and they seek salvation in a singular
outside of themselves.
Right.
Which is Antichrist, you know, but, you know, anything outside of yourself is Antichrist that you do that to. But what's so cool about it is, you know, leading up to this show, I just searched the internet to get other people's interpretations of the esoteric or the occult in this movie. And it was so cool because I learned a lot of cool stuff from a lot of different cultures. And, you know, there's like a movement going on in the young black community right now, which I think is beautiful. It's brilliant. It can be dangerous, but so can any school of thought. But it's that, you know, they're really getting to their roots and breaking the chains that were put on them psychologically and spiritually, you know, when Africans were brought here and forced to convert to Christianity. Now a lot of them are starting to understand their roots and their ancestry and get in tune with that spirit through the study of ancient Kemet or Egypt. And, you know, it's really great because they uncover a lot of the locked symbolism used for mind control. They uncover a lot of cool stuff. There's this one guy on YouTube. His name is The Real Merkaba. I love everything that he's done so far where he really breaks down the Egyptian pantheon and how he has a very similar story to me where he actually used to be a Christian in the Baptist church and how he came to understand the esoteric. And he's very good at what he does. You'll have to get him on your show one day. But at the end of the day, like after 6 hours of watching him, I had to disagree with the end game that he went to, which is that black people, and I mean, ultimately, if you boil it down, it comes to the conclusion that black people are, he doesn't come out and say it, but superior. Right? But every culture does that. You know, like Michael Tesserian. I love Michael Tesserian's work. I think it's brilliant. I could watch that stuff all night long. But then I go, okay, dude, you're basically saying that the Irish people and the Irish culture are the most advanced. And I get that, but it does come off a little, I don't know, because you're Irish. You know what I'm saying? That's like me saying life began in Georgia just because I was born here. You know what I mean?
Well, the interesting thing is that this concept of superiority is, again, usually born of an inherent understanding of oppression, right? Yeah. I mean, even the Third Reich rose from the fact that they were absolutely traumatized as a culture from World War One.
Yeah.
You know, the black supremacy rises up out of the idea that we were so oppressed, you know, generally speaking. And the Irish, the same thing. The Irish are oppressed. I mean, they were certainly not handled by the rest of Europe with kid gloves for a long time. There's always an oppressed people's reaction that leads to a supremacy concept, isn't there?
Yeah, and that's why I like the Black Panther movie. That's why I thought that one was so brilliant, because, you know, I read Black Panther as a kid. You know, I read all of them when I was a kid, and, you know, I'm colorblind when it comes to race, because I don't believe in race. You know, there's only one race on this planet, but I knew that it was a big thing for the black community when Black Panther came out, because it was like, yeah, you know, it's their first superhero. He's truly African, Wakanda, high technology. These people are super advanced. And I thought that was brilliant. Because it did catch the attention of the aware and awake black community. And at the end of that movie, I don't know if you've seen it or not, the big overarching theme that I saw was that, yes, be proud of your heritage, be proud of your color, your ethnicity, be proud of where you came from. But, you know, the whole thing was, the Black Panther's message was, but we're all one people. And all of us together can come together with our different cultures and different understandings of spirituality and politics and all this. We can all come together. Yes, be proud that you're African or African American or Irish American or Italian American. But remember that you add to the flavor of humanity. You know, so I thought Black Panther was brilliant right there. And I think that the good message that is coming from Infinity War is unity. That all these heroes could come together in unity to fight this one thing, you know. But I think that all the different interpretations of the movie that people come to is great. It's brilliant. It's diverse. And it's inclusive of other people's opinions and what their thoughts are. But what I find dangerous is that clip that I want you to play here. And it's from a very well-known YouTuber. You guys probably know who he is. Chuck, you can either say his name or not. But just for shits and giggles, I had to check with this guy. This guy he's supposed to be an uber Christian. And he's like hardcore in love with Jesus and totally not a gay way, right? But he's totally in love with Jesus. And everything that is secular is satanic Illuminati mind control, you guys. And everything is of Satan, and you should never watch it, never read it, never listen to it. It's okay that he does it for you, but you should never expose yourself to it because of X, Y, or Z. And I think, go ahead and play the clip. It's pretty long, but I want people to hear this mindset, because it's this mindset that if you look at anything esoteric or look at the world in this type of a way, I think that you're on a very dangerous path.
Right. And I plan to pause in a couple of spots here to get your commentary on this, because this is a guy who is influential on YouTube, believe it or not.
Harry, I know, man, I've lost a lot of friends because of this dude's videos, man. For real.
And he calls himself the Vigilant Christian. See, that's his justification for why he can expose himself to all of the works of the devil, because he is the Vigilant Christian.
Yeah.
And therefore, he can explain this to you, but you need to make sure that you are not contaminated by these things. And I don't want to make any more commentary about it. I think the clip will speak for itself. What do you think?
I think so, man.
And like I said, we're going to pause a couple of times and get your commentary here, but for the most part, I mean, I'm going to play this. I did not edit any of this, and it is exactly as you hear it on YouTube. There is a visual presentation along with it, and I'll even provide the link in the show if you want to go look at it. But I don't think you're going to need to after Daniel makes his commentary and I also chime in. So here we go.
All right, hey everyone, it's Mario, and you're here for a video I needed to make to go ahead and share with you that scene from the new super popular Avengers movie that right now is dominating U.S. theaters with record-breaking numbers for the debut, and I'm sure it's just going to continue. Now, for those of you who don't know, Disney absolutely hates Christians. If you haven't seen my previous videos, we need to talk about Disney, their agenda. I'll go ahead and leave it linked up in the description section below. Yeah, those Disney ears, they're going to be selling them. And they are super anti-Christian, and there you just seen a scene in which they have a character who is asked, what master do you serve? And this is a reference to the Bible. And he says, what am I supposed to say? Jesus. And everyone in the audience begins to laugh. Ha 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 ha. And so as some Christians, my brothers and sisters, you were sitting there in movie theaters, our Messiah was being mocked. And
okay. Oh, are you there?
Oh yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, wait. Hang on just a second. Okay, so for some context, it's a funny little moment on Titan whenever the Guardians of the Galaxy beat the Avengers, and there, you know, Dr. Strange says, what master do you serve? And, Star-Lord or Peter Quill says, what am I supposed to say? Jesus. Now, I thought that was funny, and, you know, I like Jesus. Like, Jesus is one of my, you know, gurus, you know what I'm saying? He's my Messiah, okay, if that makes you happy, you know, and I didn't find that offensive. You know, my interpretation of Jesus is that if he is the creator of the universe and everything, which, yeah, he is his own, then he's a really funny guy and he was fun to be around and he most certainly had a sense of humor. And anybody as humble as this guy who would wash his disciples' feet, a humble guy like that most certainly could laugh at himself. So me personally, my interpretation of Yeshua, I don't think that that's mocking at all. I mean, you know, Chuck, you, me, and other males can get together and bust each other's balls. Are you mocking me? I mean, really, dude?
Well,
really,
see, now,
dude?
Here's the funny thing.
Is Jesus
thing.
That sensitive?
Well, here's the funny thing to me. You know, there's that, but there's also, does he mean that they're mocking? I don't know how, you know, first he says, look, they're referencing scripture. Which, okay, fine.
Yeah, which, if you mention religion at all, you're referencing scripture in this dude's mindset.
Well, let's just say there is a part, I mean, and I do know that he's correct, that there's a part where somebody is asked at a certain point here, and his reference is probably correct, what master do you serve? Now, this is probably not the most uncommon of questions in a world that certainly had a rather sophisticated and multi-layered level of slavery during the time that the Bible is transpiring. Okay, so, what master do you serve could mean to ask, you know, who is your master in a slave way? I think that needs to be kept in mind. And, hey, you know what? It seems to me like you could interpret that scene in this way too. It's not about which God do you serve. It seems to me like, you know, the individuals who are asking that question are certainly devoted to Thanos and, well, you know, they're, go ahead.
It's just like, dude, really? For real? I mean, just because the name Jesus was in a joke doesn't mean that he's being mocked. I mean, I could understand that he's being mocked if, like, one of the characters said, you know, Jesus is not really the Son of God or something like that, but it kind of leaves it open-ended. But we're really overanalyzing it. It's just ridiculous that this dude's like, all right, this movie is satanic because there was a joke that had the name Jesus in it. So go ahead, play the rest.
Yeah, let's move.
In front of us, and everyone was just laughing. I mean, yeah, Jesus being a master. Ha, 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 ha. That's so funny. No, Jesus is master of master, Lord of lords, King of kings. And we live in a cultural Christian society where Christians bow the knee to the entertainment industry when they mock God because, oh, it's just entertainment, right? Well, in this video, I hope I can knock some sense into you Christians and make you realize that that is not the case.
He's going to knock some sense into us.
Well, first of all, he's going to knock some sense. Next thing is, where is it that Christians are bending a knee to the entertainment? I don't know about you, but I'm assuming that
somebody's bending a knee in this situation, but I don't know.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I know that you and I were in the movie theater, and I didn't see anybody bending a knee, and I'm assuming that we were surrounded by some Christians because we are in the Bible Belt.
I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian.
Well, you know, for those that would say you're blasphemous and all that good stuff, I mean, let's just assume that some of the other patrons might have been Christians as well. I didn't see anybody bending a knee.
No, me neither. Anyway, no. Okay. Go ahead.
Moving on.
It's not something to be brushed off. It's not something to be apathetic towards. It's something to recognize and take a bold stand against. If you love God, you stand for him against unrighteousness and those who mock him. And so this verse, for those of you who want the biblical reference, is actually found in scriptures where the Bible says you cannot serve two masters, you can't serve God and mammon.
Okay, just really quickly here. On the one hand, you bend a knee to the false God, but you stand for Christ. Okay, well, these seem to be opposing actions, and I don't know. Maybe he's confusing the NFL for the church. I'm not sure. Okay, let's go forward.
And hold on to that Bible verse, because it's really going to relate to what I'm about to share with you, because this wasn't so shocking on the basis of the fact that a Disney superhero movie is mocking Jesus. I mean, I've come to, after years and years of analyzing modern media and culture and seeing the clear godlessness of the entertainment that's being pushed onto the masses, this wouldn't surprise me. But what really shocked me...
Nobody pushing nothing on nobody. I went down there and willingly paid my $8, okay? And did it several times. It wasn't pushed on me, dude. Just saying. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry about that. How you like them apples?
Say that again, because I cut you off.
I said, I'll do it again, too. How you like them apples?
It's me, and had me being like, was the fact that in this actor, the one who, in fact, said that in the scene, is none other than supposed brother in the Lord, Christian Chris Pratt. And so you may have seen articles where he talked about Jesus transforming his life. Articles have been written on the Christian Post and websites all over the internet. He oftentimes will even tweet about it, talking about how he's praying and that the power of prayer saved his son. You can see that. The power of prayer saved my son. This boy, Sam, needs a miracle. Say a prayer for Sam.
Now, I find it fascinating that this guy is willing to judge the level of Christianity. He is a brother in Christ and all
supposed these brother in Christ. It's supposed. We have you in under investigation mode because your line of indoctrination doesn't quite line up with what my indoctrination is. So until we can verify that you're completely mindless and believe exactly what we believe, then you're in supposed land.
Well, I'm just curious who made him the arbiter of the level of Christianity, I guess, contained in a celebrity based on what? Public appearances. You could give public appearances to just about anything here because it is entertainment and you are pushing out a persona. And in fact, the things that you find online do not often fully represent the individual that they are meant to represent. That's why they call them avatars, and that's why they are things that are online in the surrogate reality. But hey, let's not talk about that, Mr. I'm on YouTube.
Let's keep going. It gets better.
Okay. Hold on.
Even if you have before, try. So Chris Pratt is known for acknowledging the power of prayer, for giving God glory, for sharing his testimony, for being on stage and receiving awards where he gives Jesus, yes, Jesus, credit and thanks. And that is very rare in today's Hollywood entertainment industry. So I was very disheartened to see this, that Chris Pratt was given a line by the Disney script for this movie where they had him make his own master, his own Lord, into a joke and mock him. I personally would not have done it. In the comment sections, please let me know if you were a Christian in a movie and had been given all this money, would you bow the knee to the Oscar, to the golden statue of Hollywood and say, you know what, yeah, it's just a joke and entertainment, and then have them record you in a scene where you are mocking the Lord Jesus Christ, and by that showing that you're ashamed of him because you won't take a stand, because that'll mean maybe I lose my role in the movie. And then when that's recorded
golden
and it's
statue,
put out in a movie,
I didn't think
that
he got an Oscar yet,
but
go ahead.
And that scene is being seen right now, I'm sure, by many, many people. And for years to come, every second of the day, I'm sure someone in the world is going to be watching that movie and hearing that joke mocking. So,
see, interesting, because, you know, I'm sure someone is going to, well, you did, fool.
Yeah, you seem to be okay, Mr. High and Mighty. You know, it didn't taint your soul.
Now, wait a minute. His Christianity. Oh, I forgot. He's the vigilant Christian. That's why.
Right. He's vigilant. That's the difference. Okay.
Okay. Oh, no, I'm just checking. You know, just. Okay.
You got it.
All right.
Really, millions and millions and millions of people will hear him betraying his Lord. And this is really disheartening because there's very few entertainers in the entertainment industry that really are unashamed of Jesus. In fact, I don't see any that are taking a real stand for Jesus. Many behind in their private life will profess that they follow Jesus, but they know that taking a stand will hurt their careers, and we don't see many stepping up to take that hit, to sacrifice the things of the world that they've been given in order to make a stand for Jesus, because when you make a stand for Jesus in this entertainment industry, especially, or basically take a stand for Jesus anywhere in the world today, there's going to come a sacrifice, a consequence. But we're called to that sacrifice for the glory of God. But not many people in the entertainment industry are capable.
Now Mel Gibson made quite the statement for Jesus some years ago, and it seems to me as though his career was just fine until he got drunk and started screaming about Jews. I don't know. You know, maybe it's just me. You know, that's really what affected his career, the fact that he did a whole huge movie about the Passion of the Christ and all that.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Maybe I'm mistaken?
No, dude.
Besides that, every year, don't they, I mean, every year and every, sometimes several times a year, don't they put out biblical movies, Hollywood?
No, they can't do it right. They need to get like a better director. You know, if I were to direct, man, if they gave me an endless budget and told me to direct the Bible, like I would do it right. But for whatever reason, man, they get some hokey filmmakers in the Christian community. Trust me, I was exposed to that crap. Anyway, go ahead, keep playing.
I want to run a lot of this next, so we're going to try and just leave it alone and let it out in the air and let you guys listen to some of this commentary for a couple of minutes. I'm going to try not to interrupt, but a couple of those things I just had to say something to, so.
Yep.
Okay.
Luke chapter 9 verse 26, for whosoever shall be ashamed of me and my words, of him the Son of Man shall be ashamed, when he shall come in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angels. And so I can even hear you lukewarm brothers and sisters out there who identify as Christians saying, I'm taking this too seriously, it's just entertainment, the guy didn't really mean it. You don't take God seriously enough. And your lax, relaxed, apathetic attitude towards this matter is really a display of your heart. And I pray that you get convicted. Jesus Christ is being mocked. How much do you really love him? Now, if you had your wife, your child, or someone that you loved here in the physical world that I could put in a movie and mock the living daylights out of in a horrible way that would bring shame to them, would you be okay with that? I doubt it. But, if it's Jesus, your Lord, your Master, the one that you're supposed to love above everything, including your mother, father, children, everything, that's okay. You want to know why? Because you don't boldly stand for Jesus.
Okay, now one quick observation here. I'm sorry, but...
Let me tell you how it is.
In every comedy that I've seen, I think, since I was born, there's usually some people who are actors and actresses who are the butts of jokes during the course of these various comedic stories that go on. And in action movies, there's comedic areas and exchanges and things like that. So the actors and actresses are often mocked. You know, for somebody who claims to be a great analyst of entertainment, I've got to say that he lacks a bit of context here, because how many fat jokes were made at the expense of, you know, John Candy, or I forget that woman that's doing really well right now. It's a very heavy actress out there, a comedic actress, but... please, you know, Roseanne Barr, when she literally played the devil in a movie, you know, another thing, where she was like this scorned ex-wife and all that kind of stuff. People getting mocked for their bodies, even if they are wearing a fat suit. I mean, Eddie Murphy did the thing with the Nutty Professor, where Dave Chappelle famously, you know, said that the guy's belt size was equator. I mean, excuse me, but everybody playing a character getting mocked in entertainment. I mean, what?
More importantly, okay, who is this dude to judge that somebody is a bad Christian and should feel very shitty about themselves if they enjoy this movie or movies like it? Who is he to judge another man's sermon?
Well, he's certainly not a lukewarm brother or sister.
Yeah, it's like guilt, fear. It's like, dude, for real? Why don't you try uplifting somebody? But I guess that's not enough YouTube views, and you do. yeah, stuff and, like that, right?
And also, here's the obligatory script.
Well, no, not to mention, Chuck, this dude talking about gold statues, you know, I don't want to get too into it, but obviously this dude has, you know, caught my attention because he's just, to me, he's toxic. But he's got, like, pictures of himself all over his shit holding the YouTube golden plaque with, you know, bling, more bling than I've ever seen, you know, and it's like, really? Really, man? For real? I mean, come on, glass houses and stones, dude. Look it up.
Well, and that's the other interesting thing. You know, his brand, The Vigilant Christian, is obviously something that is working for him. I think his videos, they look to be monetized, unless I'm missing something.
You know, there's a movie trailer. There's a monetized movie trailer at the beginning of most of his videos. Isn't that so ironic? Anyway. Keep going. It gets better, dude. It gets better.
Yeah. Let's continue on because we're actually running a little low on time, and I want to make sure we fit all of this in toward the end here. So let's go for it.
I love you enough to tell you that your fruits are rotten, and you need to stop this insanity. Okay? It's clear what you're doing. Now, this is, in essence, many of us have done this, so there's always grace and mercy applied to anyone who does not stand for Jesus. I know it's hard to in today's society to be courageous and bold and to do that. Oftentimes you will lose career, opportunity, friendship, etc. But those are the sacrifices that we are called. When Jesus said, pick up a cross and follow after me, that's what he meant. That the path that leads to life would be difficult, but he would walk it with you so that he would empower you in those difficult moments. But we all end up failing God in so many different ways. So I do extend a lot of grace and mercy to this brother and any brother or sister that's caught in this.
Extend grace?
Whoa. I didn't start you out to begin with there. You didn't get across. So
I totally miss a way. He extends grace to the other Christians that are less. He's extending the grace. It's a little odd, brother.
Brother, you know, a sibling, okay, how did you get to be my superior so that you could
extend grace?
Okay, continuing on.
We see Peter denying Jesus in the Bible. It's a very famous story where you see Peter, remember, this is the guy who ran out to Jesus on the water, said he'd never leave his side. Like, this is the passionate, on fire for Jesus guy, and he's the one who denied 3 times. But his story doesn't end there. His story doesn't end in the denial of Jesus. In fact, he repents of this, and ends up dying for the Lord Jesus, is one of the greatest apostles. And so we have to pray that this actor's life would be transformed, and that he would move from this phase right now of being ashamed, of even taking some bounty, some money, because that's what he got. He got money for the line that was in there. I mean, Christian, if you were handed the script, would you do it? And if you say yes, I am very concerned for you, because if you say you love Jesus and you could do this, your actions don't match up with your words here, okay? There's no way that true love for Christ, I know because I love him, okay, would manifest itself in those actions. It just wouldn't, okay? So good luck on that. But that's what Chris did here. Took some money, and you cannot serve God and money. So I do pray that he repents, that the Christians who are found in the entertainment industry will stop bowing to the Hollywood golden calf idol. It's idolatry. You guys need to stop idolizing these people as well. Move away from this spiritual idolatry that is so prevalent. Learn that you're going to need to stand for what is right. The right thing to do in situations like this, even if it's acting, even if it's your career, is take a stand for Jesus. And what does that mean? Yeah, he might have lost his role. Yeah, he might have lost the things of Hollywood, but guess what? Those are the things of the world that we're called to sacrifice for Jesus. That we should be counting that loss as a blessing. I count it as loss because I lost all that, but I've gained Christ. I've lost the world, but I've gained him. That's the cry of a true Christian's heart.
God really loves Jesus, man.
Man, because I love Jesus so much.
Love Jesus. Oh,
man. And look, you know what? If that's legitimately his point of view, okay, cool. But, you know, I'd really like to see him sacrifice his YouTube channel, you know, for the glory of Christ, because I bet that you could actually be a better minister to people. You could swing a dead cat at in your neighborhood, champ. But let's not do that, because I've got a brand to promote. I'm the Vigilant Christian. I'm sorry, but hypocrisy drives me crazy.
Daniel, he's found a market, that's for sure. But you know, many will call him Lord and not do the things that he tells them to do. So, you know, that's a pot in the kettle type thing with that guy. That guy's doing a shtick. If anybody really believes that this dude is some spiritual guru that they should be following for instruction specifically in what Christ actually taught, then you're fooling yourselves, dude. Don't be fooled by the flash of his logos and stuff. That's, if you look at Infinity War or anything with this twisted perspective that it's evil and you should feel dirty and ashamed for finding meaning in it, for finding yourself in it, for finding a philosophy in it, for seeing it for what art is supposed to be seen for. A way for us to look into ourselves, understand ourselves, evolve, become better people. I mean, ultimately, you say what you want to say. This guy, this movie that's so filled with symbolism and lessons and role models and great moral compasses, the one thing that this guy walked away from was that there was a joke about Jesus. Are you serious, dude? Do you think that Marvel spent 10 years and billions of dollars to lead up to one movie where a character cracks a joke about Jesus? Do you really believe that? Or was you just couldn't come up with a topic for the video of the week to get the clicks and the YouTube and the monetized that actually show Infinity War trailers before your video? So it's That's the best part of it. It's like, dude, man.
Is that because
position.
Yeah, because he tagged his stuff properly and put that in his title. Literally, guess what plays at the beginning
Infinity
of his
War
video?
Trailers. Yeah. So it's like, you know, physician, heal thyself. Look, if you perceive anything in the world with twisted views that you need to be persecuted and you need to feel like crap because you don't take some type of a stand, what are we supposed to do, dude? I mean, I'm down with Jesus. He's cool. He's hip. We're friends. Am I supposed to write Marvel a letter and tell them how much I do? What are we supposed to do? What exactly, like, take a stand for Jesus in this situation. All right, you want to give us some specifics on what Christians are supposed to do to take a stand because a Marvel movie cracked a joke with the word Jesus in it? What do you want to do, dude? I mean, really. Seriously, let's get real here. How about I just go get some popcorn?
Yeah,
enjoy the frickin' movie.
You know, that could be a way to go. And I'll tell you what we're going to do is we're going to continue on with this discussion.
We don't compromise.
Whoops. We are going to continue on with this discussion, and I'm going to play the rest of the Vigilant Christian's rant on this particular subject in the After Effects section. So if you are live at Ocelli.com or you're on the Patreon or, hey, a member at Ocelli.com, you will get the rest of the show. Daniel Lewis Crumpton is with me, but if not, that's the end of the 2 hours of the Ocelli Effect here on a Friars Day night. So the After Effect portion of the Ocelli Effect beginning now here on a Friday night. And got to tell you, I'm cracking up at something that I see in the chat room. I don't know. Are you looking at the chat room, Daniel?
Oh, now I am. What am I looking for?
Well, I see something that reminds me of the South Park.
I am so offended, Anon4512, that you would even suggest that Jesus Christ and had sex. It's just offensive to me.
I am reminded of the South Park episode, Daniel, where Eric Cartman turns around and goes into the Christian rock business in order to become a platinum-selling artist and therefore become a millionaire. And what he does is he takes love songs and changes, you know, just girl to Jesus and stuff like that. And it winds up being like these nearly semi-erotic songs devoted to Jesus. And it cracks me up. It's like, Jesus, I want you inside of me.
You mean to tell you another one that's better? You'll have to check this out. There's a group called Apologetics. It's a Christian group. You'll have to YouTube their stuff. But they take modern songs and then they redo the lyrics kind of like Weird Al Yankovic style. But they do it to like Christian, like they change the lyrics to Christian doctrine. You got to YouTube it, dude. You'll die laughing. Some of it's so great, like Metallica songs, but they just rewrite all the lyrics to, you know, like, so you're listening to Inner Sandman,
right,
but it's giving you scripture verses. You'll die, dude. You have to look it up later.
I'm going to have to check that out, but yeah, the chatter in the chat room mentions it. The name of Eric Cartman's band was Faith Plus One, which cracked me up to no end, and he's got like all this whole marketing scheme and everything, and then he freaks out because he finds out that in Christian rock, you don't get a platinum or gold album. You get like frankincense or something. And he's just like, he loses his bet, which is the big thing, and freaks out and starts screaming about God and loses all his fans and then gets struck by lightning at the end. But anyway, the Vigilant Christian thing is where we were at, but is there anything you want to get to before, because I'm going to try and cue it up again and get to the part where we left off, but anything else that we need to enter into this discussion?
No, I just think, you know, because I guess some people aren't going to hear this live, so, you know, I'm going to take my shoes off and get medicated for the third hour. But it's just, I don't know, dude. I mean, I listen to this cat, and I know that I used to hang out in Christian circles, and I can look at how it's such a form of mind control that these people are under that is supposed to be they are really conditioned to be thought police, to police their own thoughts.
Well, what literally amazes me is I'm mocking him, you know, and with good reason, I think, because how, okay, maybe I'm wrong, all right, and I'm willing to take a step back and say, perhaps I have misinterpreted something here. But it seems to me as though I've heard over the years that only God can judge people. From very devout, good, well-meaning Christian individuals have told me over the years that only God can really judge, right?
Well, they say that, but that's not actually – the Bible commands you to judge righteous judgment. So it does tell you to judge, but it says if you're going to do it fair. You know, it basically it says if I come to you, Chuck, as a Christian brother – and I'm going to get on you about your, quote, sin of doing X, Y, or Z, but I'm doing X, Y, or Z worse or at least the same. I'm a hypocrite. So it tells you, you know, first you deal with your issue, and then you may be in a position to go deal with a brother who has a problem. So it teaches to judge, but it basically teaches judge righteously, wisely, and without cutting your nose off to spite your frickin' face so that you appear all spiritual. Basically, that's what it teaches. But it does say, it says, you know, who are you to judge another man's servant? To his own master he riseth or falleth. You know what I'm saying? Every man has to give an account of himself. You know, honestly, when the Bible talks about judgment, people can get this big, bad, fearful image of a big old dude with a beard on a throne sending unbelievers or people who just didn't do right enough or say this prayer into a fiery pit of hell forever, okay? They propagate this, and it's like, no, when it's talking about the judgment seat, it's more like the Egyptian aspect of Judgment Day, which is, you know, your heart is put on a scale and a feather is put on the other side of the scale, and in order to really get out of this matrix, this cycle of death and rebirth and reincarnation or salvation or enlightenment, your heart has to be lighter than the feather or as light as the feather, you know, not heavy-hearted. And it's like when you have a mindset of the world that this guy is talking about, if you have a lens or a perspective of the world where you have to constantly be paranoid that Satan is under every bush and every, quote, Christian that calls himself a Christian may be a deceiver or whatever, under total thought police, you're going to be heavy-hearted if you stick into that world too long, you know, where even your basic human nature, human desires, needs, and wants and things like that are all labeled under sin, where you just feel guilty for doing anything. You feel guilty. You're indoctrinated to believe that you are born sinful, like you're born a pathetic piece of crap, that God had to kill his own son just to make you worth a crap. And they pull that from the Bible, and right, then they spread it like this cat. And it's like, dude, I'm sorry, but I see a lot of Christ-like messages in Infinity War. You know, I see a lot of the teachings that Jesus taught in Marvel movies in general. But honestly, I look for the message of the Christ in everything. So if that's what I see, it tells you what I'm looking for, the spirit of the Christ, not the letter of the law, the spirit of the Christ.
Well, but see, that's the interesting thing, because with this guy, okay, what I hear is...
Satan. Everything is Satan. Everything is evil. Everything is Satan. It's like, dude, man, come on, what are you...
You might be a little too young to remember this, but do you remember the church lady on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, dude. Everything is Satan. Really? Satan's a busy dude. Evidently, yeah. Satan's got more resources than God. You know, if you look at their track record, Satan seems to be more active. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Just saying. You know?
Well, and there you go. I mean, like divine inspiration. Like, I remember this was one of the first conversations you and I had, was about divine inspiration. Right. And I said to you that, you know, it seems to me as though there's a lot of books and a lot of works of art and a lot of works in general that could have been inspired by that which is divine. And that it is very difficult for me to judge really what is divine and what is not, even with the results. Let's just say, you know, sometimes there's a bad result to something. Doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't have a divine purpose, even if it appears to be an ugly result, which is interesting. So I would always tell you that I reserve judgment on that kind of thing as to whether something is inspired by, you know, the divine forces or the negative, you know, evil agenda of the adversary. It's very difficult to sort out sometimes. I mean, some things are clear, you know what I mean? But, you know, if a guy builds a bridge and it seems to, you know, create a great deal of commerce and upward mobility for an area that was previously isolated from another area, blah, blah, blah. But then that bridge collapses, you know, and kills a whole bunch of people. Is this a divine piece of work, or is this an evil one, or is this something else? Because, you know, there might be a couple of gray areas in reality as well. So... Yeah. You know, and then people could say, well, even if you think that it ends up being an awful thing because so many people died and suffered, what about if, you know, that bridge collapsing destroyed the next guy who was going to create a situation where millions would have died?
You know, another thing talking about scripture, because you know what my beliefs are. I believe all scripture or written things, scripts and whatnot, are inspired, because honestly, God is human consciousness. So if creativity comes out and you scribble it, or you create it, or you spell it, you know, like if you want to get magical about it, it's inspired by God. So I can find my inner Christ or salvation by reading a book by Paulo Coelho, you know, and it make me Christ-like just as much as the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita or any of that. It depends on what you're looking for, you know, and it's, I find it strange that I do find, you know, goodness and Christ in all of these quote pagan esoteric occult movies, but this cat and people who listen to this cat and think like this cat constantly find Satan, you know,
right?
The ego.
So with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cue it back
up. Hey everyone, it's TVC Mario,
okay. And you're going to
video.
You can hear
I need
it there,
to make,
but
to go ahead and share with you that scene from the new super popular Avengers movie that right now is the world,
there.
But our game.
Okay, now. I've just done that live, so, you know, you guys got to hear me move the needle, so to speak. But now we're actually back to a point where we left off regarding the Vigilant Christian and his presentation. So I don't want to get too far from it. I want to finish it because there's less than 2 minutes left in it. You know, in fairness, and I've edited none of this, by the way. We did stop and comment. But I didn't edit anything. I didn't remove anything. Nothing was excised. This is precisely the audio track from his video, okay? With, again, our commentary and our context. But nothing has been, you know, made to appear a certain way or anything. This is what he decided to present regarding this movie, correct?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So I'm gonna move this forward, and I have this funny feeling that, you know, we might or might not finish these last less than 2 minutes before we comment again, but I'm sure at the end of a maximum of 2 minutes, we're going to be commenting some more about this. And then I'd like to return a little bit to the movie and, oh, I don't know, get to some of the lesser, some of our Rorschach version of the movie as opposed to his, if you don't mind.
yeah, sure. I just lit up some herbs, so I think I can go into Doctor Strange land. Yeah, play this cat, man.
Okay.
Him, that's the cry of a true Christian's heart. It doesn't, we don't compromise. We in this generation need examples of Christian in the entertainment industry, in the world, in politics, everywhere. The Christians are to stand boldly and stop this compromise. Stop the wishy-washiness. We're supposed to be men of God who stand firm. If he is a true child of God, he has an obligation to be an ambassador and a strong one, because he's supposed to be a man who's standing for Christ, not compromising. And then because of a role that he's supposed to play and he justifies it with this wishy-washy, well, it's just entertainment, it's a joke, he mocks his Lord in a blockbuster movie. So I'm not here to question his salvation. That is between him and God. He could A, be a false convert, not born again, or he could be a real brother who's in compromised situations, in need of prayer and spiritual restoration, and needs to get out of Hollywood and make his life a testimony of someone who's got out of that system to stand for Jesus and talks about the sacrifices and the things that are lost by doing that. People need to see that not everyone is a sellout. The Christians are willing to say no and not bow the knee to mammon. Stand for what is right, even if it means standing alone. And so I just wanted to take a moment here to talk about that. You can go and check out other videos. There's a lot of esoteric occult symbolism that's found in the movie. There's reverse Gnosticism programming, all that stuff I've talked about. But today I just really wanted to talk about this, how we can't be compromising like this. And that Disney had an intent to give a Christian actor a line in their movie that makes him mock his own Lord. Good job, Disney. You guys are something else. Have a blessed and wonderful day. Stay vigilant and fear no evil.
Fear no evil. I find that curious that this is the way the guy ends the video. Now, where shall we go from here? Directing people to stand in a certain way and to, I guess I can see that. But here's a curious question. If, he wished to really change what's being produced out there and, I don't know, maybe produce something good to spread the word, wouldn't somebody attempt to utilize this and make it a point to introduce the concept of the Christ into, some of the things that they were producing as entertainment? I mean, is it just a complete Babylon that Hollywood is, or are there people that make an attempt? Because as in, most subsets of societies and various societies within themselves would often have a bit of diversity to them. They don't all march in lockstep. So to imagine that all of Hollywood is on the demonic agenda tip here seems a little, obtuse.
Yeah, I dropped that. One of my favorite videos on YouTube is the creationist cat exposing the vigilant Christian. I dropped it in the chat and in your Skype. But that kind of summates what I feel about this guy and kind of people like him. It's wild, dude. It very much reminds me of Pink Floyd's The Wall, and that whole scene where the kids are marching into the meat grinder through thought control. Organized religion, I don't care if it's Christian or Islam or whatever, organized institutions of religions, man, those are factories. And it's all about, getting a person so trapped in ego that they don't understand that there is no spot where God or divinity is not. And they stop, starting crusades and having witch burnings and, kind of kicking off wars in the Middle East. If they stop doing stuff like that in the name of their institutions, they might get a better rap from people like us. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't really know when the last time the Buddhists waged war with anybody or the Hindus. It's always this Abrahamic, monotheistic, Jehovah, Yaldabaoth type mindset. And it does tie into the Avengers, man, because that's what I think the big message is staring us in the face, is like, if we as a species, you know, as humanity are going to survive too much longer, we are really going to have to get over the infighting and the wars with ourselves over different names for what we conceive to be God. You know what I'm saying? And it's crazy because people like this dude and monotheistic people seem to be putting up barriers where there don't need to be barriers between cultures. And, I mean, for Christ's sake, you got the three biggest religions in the world that are entrenched in the geopolitical and military-industrial complexes of all the world's nations, bringing them all together for a real-life war in the Middle East over interpretations of allegories that were written by people who never, ever, ever intended those scriptures to be taken as literal. It's insane. But what's even more insane is that I have no doubt if we don't get over this crap, man, we're going to end up in a situation where it's not going to be a good future for us. But I don't think that the weapons of our warfare are carnal. So it's like, when I look at Infinity War, I see one, you know, because Doctor Strange, when I was younger, I used to really, really identify with Spider-Man. You know, that's what you're supposed to do with these stories, is find yourself in them so that you know where you are at in your hero's journey. If a comic book movie or any movie or music or anything calls to you, it's because it is, you know, we're all a part of an interconnected universe. It is something within you calling you to self-realization. So I used to be drawn to Spider-Man, but as I've gotten older, ironically, who do you think I'm more drawn to as I get older, Chuck?
Well, I imagine Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange. I mean, you know, as I've explored my spirituality, it's ironic that there are synchronicities there, you know, but they both use the hand mandala, you know, the same hand mandala, which Vigilant Christian calls the Diablo symbol. It means the devil when it doesn't. You know what I mean? But it's like, I look at these things as, like you were talking about, Rorschachs. These, it tells you where you're at in your life. Because whenever you and I talked about it when we left the theater, you said, I said, well, obviously it's the Old Testament. And you made a comment. You said, we remember what is past, is present, is future, because everything is cyclical. And, like, to me, when I watched this movie, I've watched it three times so far. I'll probably go again this weekend. But it was sending a very profound message to me that all of us who are spiritually minded, who are awake, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We need to utilize, while we have time, the resources that we do have, the internet, which is basically another form of digitized consciousness. And we need to turn this battle around, but not with, you know, sticks and stones and bullets and knives. We need to do it with our own. We really need to look at our own esoteric roots and do like Romans 14 talks about, which is create your own method of religion.
You know, what's interesting about the evolution of Doctor Strange, to go back to an earlier movie, is that the Ancient One, who is the master, because Strange does not start out as an enlightened character by any means. You know, in the Marvel, we'll go with the Marvel Universe, we're not going to go to the comic books exactly, okay? You know, he's a surgeon. He's a brilliant surgeon. But he's also, you know, not really connected to a lot of this stuff. Doesn't believe in it. Matter of fact, when he gets shown the chakras and a few other things, including a picture of an MRI, you know, and the Ancient One tells him that these are all maps that show you part of the picture. You know, he dismisses it. He says, you know, I've seen these things in gift shops.
He starts off very left brain. Very.
Right. Now, what happens is, the Ancient One, by the way, is a Celtic master of some sort, although you would get the impression that they were more of a, what would you say? Almost like a Buddhist type individual with the styling of certain things and all that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
clearly pointing to Druidism, you know.
Right.
The concept is that, you know, you have physical superheroes like the Avengers that protect the universe from physical threats. But the whole time these Marvel movies in this universe has been going on, what they're saying is that, but underneath the physical protectors, there is a metaphysical group of protectors that protect the universe from much larger, much more menacing threats than Thanos. Because I told you earlier, I said Doctor Strange was the most important character. Look, Doctor Strange is playing the Shiva to Brahman in Hinduism. Or I might be getting it backwards, Brahma or Brahman. But that whole dichotomy between those two deities and the dichotomy between Doctor Strange and Thanos is very, it echoes a lot. And you got to remember, Doctor Strange in his first movie or whatever, he goes up against a threat that is infinitely far more powerful and dangerous than Thanos, Dormammu. And he overcomes this infinitely larger menace through his intellect. And you see a marriage of the left brain and right brain with, he started out as a very studious surgeon, very arrogant, very egocentric, and then through trauma, he was brought into the left side, or the intuitive, mystical, magical side of his being, right? And most of what you see in Doctor Strange, like the battles and the weapons and all that, it's all mental. It's all imaginary. We're given the special effects to kind of prime our pumps. But we have to understand that they're working with energy, right? Does that make sense?
Oh, no, absolutely it makes sense. But here's the thing, is that it is not an answer which is contained in a singular discipline. That's why I brought up those maps.
Right.
Right?
Has to be a synchronization of different schools.
That's the key here, because they, literally she shows him an MRI, and she shows him you know, the chakras laid out in the typical way that we've seen, you know, by many New Age illustrators, let's call them. And it is not that any of it is to be dismissed, but it is to be laid over in transparency with one another to create a full portrait. And this is the thing that, you know, Strange has a hard time wrapping his mind around. And at one point, you know, even the separation from the physical is characterized in the earlier movie. This isn't in the Infinity War movie. But he says, listen, I can't possibly do, because my hands are shaking, I'm damaged. And he's explained, listen, it's not your hands. You're missing the point. And what did they do to show him that? They showed him someone who could do it without even a hand.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question. At that point, he's learning how to use the sling ring to open up a portal. Now, this may be a trick question, maybe not. What is that in the occult world? What is that actually showing people like you and I who practice different craft? The idea of the sling ring and it not being physical and opening a portal. What would you equate that to in, say, Wiccanism or Druidism in their practice?
Well, there's a lot of ways to go with it. You know, I'd like you to take that, because there's quite a few things there. And again, this could be a whole other 2 hour or 3 hour discussion.
Yeah, sure.
Quite honestly.
Okay. Well, when a Wiccan is about to do any type of altar work, what's the first thing that you typically in a lot of pagan circles do you do?
Well, first thing is you cleanse. You clear away all things that were there previously. You know, you begin anew, and every opportunity where you participate in something is a entirely separate event. Like, in other words, you can't carry the same effects, the same affects, the same sentiment from one thing to another. You need to be able to separate and become one of the instruments, as opposed to, you know, pushing your own will forward. Like the whole concept about, you know, how do you gain power by submission? You know, that's the interesting part of the trick there. How does that work? Because in the typical sense, this makes no sense. You know, how do you control a river? You become part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a different way of thinking that a lot of people don't wrap their minds around. You know, they even think of it in a Hollywood sense when it comes to magic. you know, my will comes together and through my focus, I will create, you know, and that is not actually what's happening. Okay. Your will plays a role, but it is not the primary driver, you see. And it is more like becoming part of that body of water which flows to begin to steer it a bit, to change its direction a bit, to change its character and its behavior a bit. This is something you do, but it's not done by force of will alone. You see, it's always about a balance. It's always about a clearing. It's always about a level playing field, if you will. Is that the point you're trying to get at?
Actually, Chuck, the answer I was looking for was casting the circle. Right?
Well, yeah, but before you do that.
Well, yeah, sure, you prepare before. But the idea, like, you know, that whenever she had, Ming or something like that. Yeah, he had no hand, but yet he could open up the portal or cast a circle. And, you know, whenever you practice any type of, you know, paganism or whatever you do, altar work, you first cast the circle before you begin your ritual, right? And it's showing you in a visual way, and unless you actually do any kind of altar work of traditional stuff, schools, then you wouldn't really pick up on it. But it starts, I mean, it right there, it's, there are a ton of stuff online, so I don't want to exhaust it, of so many Easter eggs in this movie about, one, the hero's journey, or the initiation into the mysteries, because typically, you know, all of our initiations into the mystery schools, they're not the same. It's not the same path, but they all rhyme. You know what I'm saying? Like how you were called to a spiritual life and how I was. They're not the same details, but you could see a theme going throughout it. Does that make sense?
Well, no, it does. But I stand by my point though, because before you even cast that circle though. That's the thing that is missed here in a lot of this, is that, you know, it's not about your desire, your will necessarily. That's the path to a problem, and this is something that is shown here in this entire discussion, if you think about it, mm-hmm. right? Because, again, you know, the point about Thanos could have very easily just said, well, listen, I've got the power to change time, mind, soul, everything, pretty much. And why not simply make everything an endless supply of plenty? You know, why not provide so that life could thrive and thrive and thrive some more? And, hey, if it outgrew the planets, create more planets.
Well, we could do like a long show on Doctor Strange, the first movie, but I think like when you watch the first Doctor Strange, it is the initiation of the pyramid. You know, it's walking somebody through the stages of initiation on so many different levels, and it, especially his obsession with time, right? Before he gets into the mystic arts, he's fixated on time. With, you know, the watches that he has, to telling Dr. West to cover his watch. And ironically, you know, I found out today that whenever they try to steal his watch, the three thugs in the avenue, which rhymes very much with Freemasonry, with the whole legend of Hiram Abiff, you know, getting murdered by the three apprentices or whatever. When he drops the watch, it actually, the date stops on Groundhog's Day, which was kind of like a tip to the hat of a movie that years ago that was about looped time, right? Little things like that they put in Doctor Strange, to the fact that the surgery that you meet him in the movie, he's doing surgery on somebody's midbrain. So it's telling you that's where the journey starts. That's where the problem is. There's a bullet in this guy's brain, right? And it you know, as he goes through the mystic arts, they do reference real books like the Book of Cagliostro and things like that. And Doctor Strange teaches a lot of truth. It really, really does.
But again, here's an interesting point, right? Why do I talk about this this need to cleanse and to be clear, you know, to have clarity before even beginning to cast the circle? Here's why, okay? Because whatever you take in there, is going to have an influence, and you must be very careful with that. Now, what happens to Strange here is interesting, because in the superficial world, where he's still this surgeon, he's rushing with his sports car at one point and communicating over the phone. And what is he saying constantly? Well, that's not worth my time. So everything is about time with him, no matter what. Now, it's fascinating, because here it is, the positive end of it. Once you learn how this actually works, he wasn't concerned with the value of time any longer, but he could literally control it. That's an interesting thing about it, right? Is that when you're not coveting something, when you're not so desirous of it, but you have an openness to it and a willingness to absorb that which has been placed in front of you. Because remember, even his instruments chose him. Uh-huh. He didn't choose his own instruments here. And this is an interesting thematic thing that develops during the Strange movie. Now,
yeah.
You'd almost think that this would be the out for the scriptwriter for the next Marvel movie here, because why not just have Strange somehow, have presets so that you can rewind time? I don't think it'll be that simple, though. I feel like the Soul Stone is the key to the next part. But
here's the thing. I mean, this is my view as a fanboy. There is clearly, from the end of the first Doctor Strange movie to Infinity Wars, there is clearly, an acceleration of his ability to use magic. You know, by the end of the first one, he was kind of, clumsy, with it, and he kind of used his brain to get out of the whole conflict of the story. But when Infinity War picks up, he is highly advanced. He's, as he likes to say, the master of the mystic arts. So there was an acceleration in his ability to learn the mystic arts and things like that. But, yeah, it even gets down to, it's very much pointing to the Kundalini process, with the cloak of levitation or ascension, tying at the nape of the neck. And, whenever it's red on the outside, but when it flares up, it's the Freemasonic checkerboard. There's tons of stuff like that in the movie. You could pick that movie apart for days, but what's the way I look at it is, is Thanos really a threat to Doctor Strange at all, or is Doctor Strange just allowing the participants in one universe of a multiverse to play out their parts? Just like we always say, as above, so below; as within, so without. We find that what's going on in the heavens, or with the Maseroth of the Zodiac. All those anthropomorphized things that we put on the stars, it actually does have an effect on human history down here on Earth. So it truly is as above, so below; as within, so without, right? So it's like, when I look at that, the Doctor Strange character is honestly more of an observer in this conflict, maybe a passive participant, because let's face it, he had the Time Stone, and Thanos does point out, he says, you never used your most powerful weapon. Doctor Strange could have easily rewound time during that fight to make all of the Avengers win, but he just chose not to. Don't tell me he wasn't smart enough or that that's a plot hole. I just don't think that that's so. I think that because of his adeptness at the mystic arts and being able to look into 14,605 possible timelines, he already knows how it's going to turn out and how to make it turn out in the right way. So it's like, is he really afraid at any point once he knows the future?
But you see how, again, surrender is an interesting part of this? Because even in the situation in the previous movie where he's stuck in the time loop, he has literally given himself up to the idea that this guy is going to repeatedly murder him.
Yeah.
And we're going to be stuck in this loop together, so you can just keep killing me. And this is when he's not even all, as deeply adept as he is in the Infinity War movie. He's already there. He's caught the lesson of submission to the stream. And this was it. Now, again, it doesn't mean that your will plays no part, but it is not the primary focus. That's why I found it a little interesting that Tony Stark had to survive. because that was his condition. That was the like the only thing he could have asked for. I mean, he could have said, "Listen, I got a bargain, and this is what I want, and you know, I'll do this if you give me this." And just assuming, you know, also interesting that he knew that Thanos would keep his bargain too.
Yeah.
You know, but what's fascinating is that this was the only condition that he was insistent upon. Everything else, regardless of what he had said up to that point, he released when he turned over the time stone.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's only fan theories and a few pictures, like, on the set of the next installment, but, like, the prevailing theory is that I think there have been shots of the scene at the end of the very first Avengers where the big battle happens. There are shots of Tony Stark and Ant-Man there wearing these chronometer type devices. So what we do kind of know is that time travel is certainly going to be involved in it, right? And so if that's the case, and what Marvel is really pointing at is what's going on geopolitically and on this planet, if we are reflecting it on, from a subconscious level into our arts, like cinema, like the movies, or like this movie in particular, what it's going to take ultimately to overcome our adversity or this negative force that seems to be pushing humanity to the brink of blowing themselves up, it's going to have to do with mental stuff, okay, consciousness. It can't be flesh and blood, can't be carnal weapons. It's got to do with consciousness, and it has to do with time and rewriting history. Because since 1947, up into the internet age, one thing that we have the privilege of is that now, for the first time in centuries, we as a species are able to look at alternative views of our history as a species. And this is changing our consciousness. Because honestly, I'm not even joking with you, getting back to the Baptist thing. When you get in seriously hardcore Christian circles that really take the book literally and have calculated the amount of years from Adam to, you know, whatever, they literally believe that this earth is only the universe is only 6,000 years old. They literally believe that. Okay? So, how is that possible? This is a severe neglect of information outside of what you're being told, clearly. Because an idiot with a laptop or a smartphone can find proof that this planet is much older. This universe is much older than 6,000 years. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, thankfully now we have the opportunity to take a different look at our past. And that, in effect, like the butterfly effect, is changing our present. Because, I mean, like we were talking about on the show last week, history or your outlook on life is going to change significantly if the Old Testament is literal history or if it's allegory, right?
Right.
Your cultural identity has to be reexamined. Your religious identity has to be reexamined. Your place in the world has to be reexamined, right? And it's just it's a matter of choosing different perspectives of history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why they're tying into the next one that, you know, ultimately, if you believe that there is one all-powerful vortex or singularity of power, either good or evil, okay, either the Galactic Federation of Lightworkers or whatever, or Satan's demons, if you believe that there's like a singularity, it's I don't know. I think it's wanting you to face the big problem is that I see in the world is ego, you know, and this determination to stay identified or to maintain an identity that's been placed upon you by the world, whether it be your race, your religion, your location on the planet. As long as you cling to those titles, you know, I think that it's not a good thing for humanity, because ultimately at the end of the day, it just creates separation. You know what I'm saying? Am I rambling a little too much or going too deep with it? I think ultimately what I think is we have to really reexamine everything that we've ever been told, and we have to do it in a non-angry way, you know, non-accusatory way, non-victim way. And then maybe we can get somewhere. Because, let's face it, dude, you know, like we were talking about with the show on Israel and Palestine, it's insane that there is a place on the planet where genocide is happening. I mean, it's happening, you know, and it's being supported by the mightiest country in the world, allegedly us, all because of a story of propaganda. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And honestly, like, I love every faith. I love spiritual people. But I swear to God, Chuck, organized religion and the idea of a monotheistic, judgmental, wrathful deity or whatever, I think that it's messing us up. It's really, really messing us up. And I think that, like, the cinema culture, the art culture is echoing themes like in this movie, which is, it's not satanic, okay? It's just attacking the idea of concentrated power, you know, whether that be political or whether it be in religion. It's a bad thing, man. It's bad. Divinity is everywhere. And the acting or behaving or propagating anything other than that is just destructive.
Well, the other thing to understand is that, you know, it appears to me as though a lesson needs to be learned here that regardless of what it is you see and you judge something to be, you must understand that, you know, not everything is either black or white either. Now it's like, well, wait a minute, you're making the satanic argument. No, I'm not. I'm trying to explain that there is nuance here, and that, you know, because something seems to be so impactful does not necessarily mean that you must decide whether it lies on the ultimate good or the ultimate evil side of things. Some things are just things. Like I said, you know what, occasionally with Disney, a mouse is a mouse. Okay.
At the end of the day, though, I mean, you know, it's great to pick things apart like that, but on just the surface level and really the level that you should approach stuff like this, it was a damn good story. It was really well executed. It allowed me 2 hours, 45 minutes to escape from the burdens of, you know, the humdrum life and reality that we're surrounded by. It gave me escapism. It entertained me. You know what I'm saying? I took value from it. And so, you know, and I think that it has enriched my life. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, it is a movie. It's escapism. And if it offers you the opportunity to be self, introspective or to advance, great. It's at least hitting the masses on a subconscious level to explore these topics and issues on some level. You know what I'm saying? So kudos to them.
Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing here, because again, the aspects of the Power Stones are great as far as I'm concerned. The Infinity Stones, let me get that straight. Because the powers in each of them, okay, you could, again, with the Rorschach test, focus on one or the other. You know, you and I have sort of focused on the Time Stone, and I keep bringing up the Soul Stone because I just got this feeling that is a serious key. There's a reason why, you know, that is the only one which is sentient. Okay. And it's not like I'm trying to be predictive about the programming that's about to arrive. I'm trying to tell you that there is a uniqueness.
Well, here's the way I look at it. One time I was asked by one of my guides in this spiritual walk. They asked me, they said, do you know how Jesus could tell the future? And I said, yeah, he read the book of Daniel. And then he played it out. He played the role of the Messiah out like an actor would a script. Okay. And the guy, my guide, who's much older and wiser than me, said, that's exactly correct. You know, we know that the character of Yeshua or the person of Yeshua wasn't omniscient. You know, he needed prayer. He needed guidance. He did not know everything. Okay. So how did he know the general path? And it was by reading the, you know, a script of the book of Daniel. And so honestly, whenever, you know, if you really want to be a prophet of your own life, if you're drawn to a story, like clearly, you know, we are to the Marvel movies, find yourself within that story. You know, find what resonates with you and you'll be able to kind of be clairvoyant a little bit, because there's nothing new under the sun. All of us are going through a hero's journey. And I think that ultimately the symbolism that they are putting in all these kind of movies is putting some type of a grip down for people to put traction to on their evolution if when they're ready. You know, they got to crank the car up and hit the gas, but at least, you know, what I find is like, if you read the New Testament, it said that everything that Jesus taught, he taught in parables. And there was nothing that he taught that wasn't in a parable. And that what that means is he told stories. Because through stories, we can relate to concepts and each other and ideas that are almost inarticulable. You know what I'm saying? We find ourselves through stories, fictions. And it's because it's coming from us and it's feeding back into us. All of us want to be a superhero. You know what I'm saying? Or someone special. And we are, right, if it, when whenever we realize that anybody who tells you that you're not is anti-Christ, you know, anybody who is making you be a police your own thoughts or make you feel dirty or filthy or rejected by God, if they're teaching that, and I don't care who it is, man, that's not true. All of us have the ability to tap into ourselves and really change things through energy, you know, through our consciousness, not through, you know, you can go to a billion protests and marches and elections. You're not going to affect the world as much as your energy, your conscious energy and your emotional energy. You know what I'm saying? You could look up all kinds of studies where, you know, they have people, a ton of people get together and meditate for 30 minutes, you know, in a specific city, and they statistics show that crime goes down. You know what I'm saying? Like, conscious thought does affect reality. It's proven. It's not like a theory. It's proven. If you get an idea or a concept or an intent injected into the mass of the collective consciousness and they start meditating on it or willing it to be so, it will come about. And so what's happened up until this generation is that the collective consciousness has been indoctrinated to believe that some Armageddon is coming. Some final conflict is coming, and it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Look at the Middle East.
Well, see, and again, you know, that's why I brought up the struggle between life and death at the beginning and the thematic origins of that, because there's a reason why this continues to repeat as a story in religion, in any culture. There's a reason for it, and it is the conditioning. And this is also why I brought up the generational struggle, because we have an opportunity, okay, to introduce not necessarily something new, because like you said, there's nothing new under the sun, right? But we have an opportunity to reintroduce the original foundational concepts, if you will, but with fresh blood, okay, with the next generation of individuals who aren't going to make necessarily the same mistakes. Because here's another thing to keep in mind. In order to get to this point, right, it is the mistakes of the past that get us to this point. You need to learn from history to stop repeating it. And, you know, and sometimes when we do that, it seems as though there is a cycle that brings us to a point where for a little while something won't happen until people begin to forget about it. And that's an interesting point here. And I think this is what's going to play a significant role in what comes next. Because that's the great thing. And I don't think that we need to necessarily go through, you know, the cataclysm, if you will. You didn't have a very violent departure of half the population of the universe. They just departed. And, you know, you don't need to do it that way. If you want to go it and do it the hard way, well, you know, it can be done the hard way as well. But I think that there is a chance to evolve here because of an interesting point in our history where eventually it will be history. It is current events right now, but eventually this will be history. And there is a point here where we can change the trajectory. And it is going to be left to, sorry to say this, Daniel, but people younger than ourselves are going to pick this up and are going to work with it. And I think it is incumbent upon us to explain to them that they don't need to repeat the mistakes of the ones who came before us.
Yeah, me and you, this might open up a can of worms, but both of our fathers were veterans and everything. And me and you were, I hope it's okay if I say this on the radio.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, the conversation, okay. But, you know, I was talking about how my dad served in two foreign wars, and he did it because, you know, he believed in his country, and he believed that what he was fighting for was patriotic, and it wasn't until he was in his 70s that he discovered that, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin never happened. You know what I'm saying? And he realized that his youth and his energy and his passion had been used by deceivers, right? And, you know, your father has a similar story. It's like that entire generation didn't have the advantage of information. And we have the internet. So we can't really blame our fathers for joining up and going and fighting in globalist wars because they didn't know. They didn't know better. They found out later, and they didn't know better. But what is the excuse of kids like millennials that join the military? You know, I forget who it was that said, you know, if you want world peace, you have to basically convince the youth of the world to not enlist in the military. You know, it's like, dude, what is the excuse of 18-year-olds and stuff that do have the ability to look up anything on the internet and find out that your government's lying to you about things? You know, what's your excuse when you do sign up to go over into a different country that didn't ask you to be there, kill their people, you know, because you were ordered to? You know what I'm saying? That's insane. The idea of war, if we really stop and think about it, it's insane.
Right.
The whole idea of funding a military-industrial complex to wage war is hell. And so I don't understand what the excuse is today, you know, in the internet age, for people to be joining the military. You know, it's wild, dude. It's wild. I don't know what the excuse is. So,
but that's the thing. It's the organization. You see, just like organized religion, just like these political parties of old, you know, the grand old party, the GOP, right? A lot of people don't even know that's what that means. You know, in the Democratic Party and the all these things which are, you know, parties that don't seem like they serve cake and ice cream, you know, except at local events. I know. Don't even correct me. But I'm just, and I didn't mean you, Daniel. I'm saying to somebody listening. Point is that there is a way to look at this, and it is we can all do better. And I feel as though my generation and those who slightly preceded me and those who, you know, came just slightly after me, we are obligated to change this because we had a taste of both sides. You see, in the 1970s, as a child and I was learning about the world around me, there was absolutely none of this connectivity. You know what I mean? There was none of this possibility.
Yeah, but I bet you after Kennedy got shot, Bobby Kennedy got shot, and Martin Luther King got shot, you guys started asking some questions.
Well, in the 70s, those questions were just starting to get asked. That's why there were so many. There were even, you know, Congress couldn't ignore the people's outcry. That's why there was a Rockefeller Pike, I'm drawing a blank here, but 5-6 different commissions through the Congress, private investigations, all kinds of stuff going on related to not just Kennedy, but, you know, the attempts to kill Castro, the overthrow in Guatemala, what happened to Lumumba in the Congo. All of that stuff started to come out in the public because the public started to smell a rat. That was just the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the beginning of... Were you
asking questions while that stuff was going on?
Well, at a very young age, I was asking some odd questions like, how is it that a guy... the only way a guy dies in police custody is if the police killed him. That's Lee Harvey Oswald, obviously. That was my big question to begin with. But here's the thing. We didn't have the tools. We had questions, but we didn't have the tools. And even though there were congressional hearings and some of them ended up on TV, you know, you didn't catch replays. You didn't have DVRs and YouTube and all that. So... honestly, there was a few informed people that started sounding a lot of alarms about these different organizations of all sorts, not just the military, not just we were lied to about Vietnam, not just we were lied to about Watergate, not just we were lied to about the Kennedy assassination, but, hey, listen, your religious organizations, guess what we're finding out about them? Some of them are not very religious. Some of them are out there to get your money. Some of them, well, but hang on, there was more to it. It was like, listen, you need to begin to examine these things for yourself and don't simply rely upon the appeal to authority. Now, after growing up in that age where those questions started to be asked and media started to evolve, we didn't really get introduced into all this deeply except through underground publications until the internet. So we lived in a transitional time period here. You're a little younger than me. But people a little bit older than me and a little bit younger than me all can put an identifier on this, whether you were growing up in the 80s, the 70s, or the late 60s, somewhere in there, you know what I'm talking about.
All right, so let me ask you a question. Okay. I mean, I don't think you and I have ever discussed this together, but what was your take, having lived through a good bit of that, and in the age of when Americans first started to question their government, although it was sparse and few and far between, what were your thoughts on the Apollo missions and the moon? Like, I don't think I've ever asked you, what's your take on the moon landing? In an age when questioning the government came along, did you guys back then think that shit was real? I'm not saying it wasn't real. I'm not saying it wasn't real. I'm just saying, what did you think?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I watched from my eighth grade class, I think, when the Challenger exploded. That was the point at which we started questioning whether this was even, you know, something that needed to be done. Is this not a waste? Is this – what is actually happening? Because we get some of these, you know, TV programs out of it and all that, but what are we getting out of this? That's where it went. But the idea that the moon landing had been faked had not been an idea that really circulated until later.
Okay.
You know, I don't believe that we have the correct footage, but I do believe that that space travel has been achieved and repeatedly, and probably we don't know the extent of what actually has happened.
Okay, well, look, I'm not going to do the flat Earth thing. I've already exhausted all that and all that. I know that NASA tells some lies. Okay, I know that.
Right.
I know the history of NASA. I know that. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they have dubiously lost records, artifacts, and videotape. Officially, I'm not making up any conspiracy theory. Check with NASA yourself. You'll find that there are portions of entire Apollo missions which are just poof lost, and other things that are just poof lost somehow.
What's his name? Gus Grissom was he was very critical of NASA and. I think on one news feed, he put a lemon on top of the capsule or whatever, and said our chances of going to the moon are very slim. And then, of course, shortly before that fire that killed Grissom and two other astronauts, he had told his wife. He said, you know, something to the effect of, if there's ever a serious accident in the space program, it'll probably be me. And then next thing they know, they burn up in the Apollo pod, right? And his son became an astrophysicist or some crap, aerodynamic engineer, I don't know, and reopened the investigation years later and got to look inside that capsule and found, you know, that obviously this was sabotage. Somebody put some thingamabob in the dashboard whose only purpose could be to start a spark in a highly oxygenated enclosed space with a sealed hatch that should be easy to open. So you have a lot of mysterious deaths, you know, going on with NASA. So, yeah, there's some dark stuff happening with NASA. But, and I don't know. I don't know what I do know is a lot of the pictures that I've seen of the Apollo moon landings, just to a layman, a lot of that crap don't make sense. You know, if the sun's over here and it's the only light source and you can see the front of the lunar limb clearly enough to read the United States, something's up. Okay, and by the way, 2001 A Space Odyssey looks an awful lot like this. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. What I do know is this. I do know that there was a think tank, at the charter of NASA. The name escapes me at the moment. But anybody can YouTube it or Google it. It's fascinating stuff. They had a think tank come together before NASA was chartered, and they said, "Okay, look, we're gonna basically this is what it was. It was like we're gonna kick around the universe, you know, and space shuttles and stuff, and we're gonna try to explore like the moon and Mars and other planets. What do you guys think would be the result if, say, we happened to get up there and found, I don't know, signs of, you know, artificial or not artificial extraterrestrial life?" Like if we started finding geometry and architecture out on the moon, let's right. say, what would the effect on the American population be? And so this think tank basically came back and they said, look, if you guys go, say, to the moon and you find some proof of extraterrestrial life, it would basically bring about the end of every world government, every world economy, and every world religion. It would be absolute chaos if the people were to know that we are not alone. And that's what NASA was chartered on. Now, we're going to use all this taxpayers' money to go explore, to see if, you know, set up SETI and all this other good stuff and see if there's extraterrestrial life. But if we find it, we are never going to tell you. Okay.
Oh yeah. So yeah, no. That kind of cover up, I believe, is possible and makes sense. Honestly, to the degree that I could believe that happened, I'm not saying that I agree with it. But you know, it's a whole different story to talk about. You know, because even the sun itself, I got to be honest with you, observationally, the sun is not a light source. That's what kills me. It's actually not a light source.
Well, look. Now, when that study was done and NASA was, you know, in those phases, I agree with the assessment, Chuck. I believe that if back then it would have been like there was disclosure that, hey, we're not alone, and, you know, not only are we not alone, we're surrounded.
Yeah.
Back then it probably would have done it, but I think that through the decades, enough people have been acclimatized to the idea that at any minute, you know, the spaceship could land, and we wouldn't be so shocked, you know, at this point. So, but I mean, and the evidences that are out there, say on Mars or in the rings of Saturn or on the moon, like Richard Hoagland, I've been a fanatic Richard Hoagland follower since I was, you know, way back when it was on VHS tapes. And there's no doubt that there's geometry on the moon, at least the moon, and not just geometry, big geometry. And it's also very obvious to anybody who's seen like the photos of Cydonia with the face on Mars. It is obvious that's just a duplication of Giza. It's just there's too many coincidences with the math and the pyramids and the Sphinx. So, you know, it's like on one hand, NASA does like toe the line of like, we're alone, you know, nothing to see here. But then again, there are people in NASA who are leaking the photos that allow alternative investigators to say, wait a second, you know, there's pyramids on Mars. Or wait a second, there's a glass dome that's 10 miles high and 10 miles wide on the moon. And oh, by the way, the moon might be hollow or artificial. I mean, you got some peer-reviewed dudes out there talking about, you know, the moon might be an artificial construct, but you'll call David Icke or people like David Icke insane for saying it. You know what I'm saying? It's wild.
No, I know, but that's part of the game here, because at the end of the day, you know, you do have to acclimate the public before revealing some of these revelatory things. The intelligence agencies worked on various projects, you know, with the idea, and you notice they never tried to pull it off, but with the idea that they could introduce aliens to different cultures and, you know, freak them out enough that we wouldn't even have to fight them because they would be so terrorized by the idea. But notice that was never implemented. You know what I'm saying? You know, Project Bluebeam and stuff like that. I mean, there's been some documentation related to it. And to say that, you know, NASA's been entirely honest is ridiculous. To say that any of these institutions hasn't been, you know, some sort of gatekeeper regarding the whole of the reality is something that I can't understand any longer. But like I said, we've lived through a transitional time period where initially the authority was the authority and you could trust them. That was the concept that was given. Now, again, I was born at exactly that turning point because the Kennedy assassination changed things for a lot of people. But then when you saw 1968 come and go, where, you know, Dr. King was killed, Bobby Kennedy's killed, various other individuals are killed one way or another, a lot of names you don't even know, but almost anybody who stuck their head up and wanted to change the status quo one way or another got nailed down. You know, the nail that's up gets the hammer. They all got nailed down. In 1968, COINTELPRO at full swing. Anything that was going to change things a little too radically was immediately tamped down. And I think that that's been, you know, not unique to 1968. That's been something that's been continuous. But here's the interesting part of it, is that alternative culture or even pop culture in one way or another serves a grander purpose to allow people to expand their ideas.
Yeah.
And here you go. Now, aliens are not that big, scary, crazy, the Earth stood still. Oh, my God, we heard a radio broadcast, War of the Worlds, Orson Welles, people literally freaking out because they heard part of it being acted out on the radio. Kind of interesting. That would not happen today. You know, even if somebody did get on, you know, Fox News and kind of put out something that looked like that, it would probably be thought of as, I mean, I'm sure a few people would lose their minds and do something crazy, but it wouldn't be a massive problem, and it would be thought of as a performance art piece, and, oh, it's just, you know, a lot of ho-hum, too, a lot of yawning, oh, another alien project, you know. It's become a bit more normalized, and I think that a lot of these other interesting explorations into the esoteric are designed to do exactly the same thing, to prepare people.
That's what I loved about, you know, the whole idea with the Marvel movies is, like, in other movies where it's the plot involves aliens, like, they have to build up to the fact that there are aliens. But when you jump into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's like, it's a given. Like, you should already know that.
Okay.
Not only should already know that, but, like, with this one, there was so much, because it's like you have to address the issues that we as a generation are facing with every tool in your toolkit, which is, you know, metaphysical, mental, a bit of physical, you know, and all the different heroes represent that. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. And look, with all that having been said, believe it or not, we've gone well over 3 hours here. And
it's 11:11, light workers.
There you are. So that's why I'm kind of applying the brakes at this point in time. Obviously, you and I could continue to discuss this for more hours if we wanted to. And you've certainly now gone into some interesting areas that I didn't expect you to go into. But I think that this is an interesting discussion. And overall, let me just say this, too. The Infinity War movie is entertaining on the surface. It is interesting in a psychological and emotional sense. The suspension of disbelief and all that kind of good stuff is well in play. It's well done. It's scripted nicely. There's, you know, recognizable iconic characters mixed in with newer innovations, you know, that make it, you know, just a fascinating visual presentation.
Well, at the end of the day, and this, I'll say this, and then we can go, or, you know, unless you have something else to say. Not that I'm telling you what to do or anything. It's just I'll say this. It's the last thing I'll say. Is just on its surface, as a guy who's waited 30 years of being educated and being able to engage my right brain and imagination through these characters, through this universe, you know, through all the comics, as somebody who has waited 30 years to see all of that stuff on the big screen, not only done, but done well, you know, to not destroy my childhood, I have to say, as a Marvel fan, they set a bar so high when they started the whole MCU. And with this particular film, just as a fan and as a critic and as just a human being, they went so far above the bar that I am so satisfied as a geek. You know what I mean? It was a good time, and the next one's going to be a good time. And at the end of the day, that's really, really what it's about, is enjoying the art of other human beings and having a good time, man.
And with, look, with very few exceptions, let's be honest here, even the greater expansive universe has been extremely satisfying as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I talked about Punisher on here, you know, various, I did multiple parts about it. That is part of the Marvel universe. And, you know, I'm not quite as thrilled with Daredevil, but anyway, that's just me. Jessica Jones is interesting. I mean, all this stuff has come together rather nicely. There have been very few, fails, if you will. But they've created something extremely diverse, well-textured, well-structured, no matter what the platform was or seemingly the budgets, because the budgets have varied quite a bit and they've done pretty well no matter what they were working with.
It's basically it's a multiplicity of avenues and invitations for a person to discover their highest self through resonance.
Exactly. And I can't think of a better way to end this entire discussion, because all of it circles exactly around what you just said.
It's quite brilliant, wasn't it?
That is what it is. It is about self-discovery. And through discovering the self, wait a minute, what happens when you truly discover the self?
I'm supposed to answer that?
Yes.
You get to the prize in the middle of the Tootsie Roll Pop. I don't know.
That too. How many licks does it take? Let's ask Mr. Owl. Anyway, nobody has any idea what I'm talking about unless you're at least 45 years old. But that's all right. We'll get to that on another day. Anyways, Infinity War was certainly a curiously great thing, and you and I went to the theater together to see that. I do enjoy going to the movies with you. It is fun, and not just because you usually wind up paying, but...
It's because I sneak my lightsaber in and we get high.
Well, listen, there's always that too, but don't say it too loud. I don't know how many listeners we have in Georgia. Anyways, Daniel Lewis Crumpton was with me for now more than 3 hours on this particular discussion, but I think it's all well worth it, and I do appreciate you guys for sticking around, because if you heard all this, you were either on the live stream, my Patreon, or at Ocelli.com as a member. So, Daniel, any parting words, my friend?
DownloadedContent.com.
Absolutely. DownloadedContent.com is your website, and there are a variety of things over there already. And I have this funny feeling there is more to come in the very near future. Never know, that might be one of your paths to enlightenment out there, depending on who you are, huh?
I'll never tell.
That's it. Neither will I. The Ocelli Effect is done. Once again, I am merely Ocelli. All of you who listen, participate, do anything surrounding the show are the effect. Have a good night.